welcome all our witnesses this morning. We can expect a diversity of views and opinions on one of the most important issues facing us this session, the future of the Internet and e-commerce transactions. I believe that we're at a critical juncture in determining the future regulatory scheme under which the new economy will either continue to grow and prosper or will be thwarted by government bureaucracy, taxation, and short-sighted greed. Our founding fathers certainly did not have the Internet in mind, but nevertheless understood the potential dangers and pitfalls of states taxing and regulating interstate commerce. That's why our Constitution reserves the power to regulate commerce among the several states. The purpose of federal power over interstate commerce is to ensure that one or more states do not unduly burden the transaction of interstate transactions. The Internet is the epitome of interstate commerce. If each state and local jurisdiction attempts to impose its own business regulations and taxes to it, the opportunities presented by this new economic engine will be destroyed. It's important to look at the full picture of our economy, is assessing the impact of taxation on the Internet and the e-commerce. The Internet is filled with websites of small businesses, businesses that are expanding in ways which would never have before been economically feasible. One of our witnesses today, Mr. Morse, will be able to give us a reality check as to how the Internet has afforded him an opportunity to compete with much larger companies. The Internet is the last frontier for the small business entrepreneur to develop a business and compete without massive amounts of investment capital. His or her small business, which is his small business, which has historically had a limited market for its goods, now has a website that allows him to market and sell to people all over the country, even all over the world. Mr. Morse, like other small businessmen and women, benefit from the freedom of the Internet, and the country benefits from their success. When a small business increases its sales and revenues, it needs to hire more employees, and it pays taxes on the increased revenues, and the newly hired employees pay taxes on their wages. The state and local governments benefit not only from the additional taxes paid on the revenues, but in the economic benefits of additional jobs and a growing economy. The potential burden of complying with tax regulations and the paperwork involved under current law for as many as 7,500 estimated taxing units in this country would overwhelm many businesses, especially small businesses. The cost of complying with multiple states' filing and regulatory requirements would in many instances exceed the amounts collected and transmitted. A multi-state company currently files many tax returns. AT&T has informed the committee staff that last year it completed approximately 99,000 separate tax filings. Under current law, a state can require businesses who have a nexus with the state to collect taxes, collect sales and use taxes. The moratorium does not disrupt this existing law, nor would an extension of the moratorium. The Supreme Court has found that businesses with a physical nexus to a state have created a relationship with that state sufficient to submit themselves to the regulatory and taxing authority of that state. In essence, the business becomes a citizen of the state, and its transactions with other citizens of that state are intrastate in nature. Thus, there is no burden on interstate commerce. By contrast, the essence of what the tax and spend advocates who oppose this legislation demand is 50-state jurisdiction over every Internet business, large and small, regardless of any other connection to each state. They advocate that a Vermont businessman, such as Mr. Morse, collect sales taxes and comply with the tax regulations of every state and local jurisdiction in the country. Where does this expansive jurisdiction lead? Does such an expansive jurisdiction also result in potential liability in each state for noncompliance or miscompliance with state regulations? What about business licenses, occupational fees, occupational or retail licensing regulations, blue laws? How do we ensure that in the zeal to collect more money, to permit even more expansive governments, we protect the privacy of the consumers? How does imposing more regulatory burdens affect competition in the marketplace? What impact does increasing the regulatory and tax burden on Internet commerce have on rural, handicapped, and low-income consumers? How does it affect our trade opportunities with other countries? We need to consider whether the macroeconomic benefits of the new economy will outweigh the potential losses in direct revenues. We must ensure a level playing field for all venues of commerce, not simply create a new remote sales tax system. We must simplify the overwhelming morass of tax rules, regulations, and paperwork so that opportunities for new or small businesses are not lost in complex and archaic bureaucracies. We need to re-examine the level of services which the public wants to be provided by government and determine how to provide necessary revenue to accomplish the people's will. We need to ensure that taxation is not simply imposed to increase government bureaucracy. I'm looking forward to hearing from the witnesses on all of these issues. It's clear that these are complex issues which will require extensive investigation, analysis, and debate. The commission established by the Internet Freedom Act did not reach consensus, nor did it resolve the multitude of issues presented by the new framework of interstate commerce which the Internet presents. I do not see how we can arrive at consensus on these critical issues between now and October of next year, which is why I proposed a 5-year simple extension of the current moratorium. The extension would not affect the current nexus rules. It would not affect the grandfather provisions. It is a simple extension of the status quo. It had been my intent to include S-2255, the 5-year moratorium extension, legislation on the committee markup tomorrow. The advocates of increasing the tax burden on the public have prevailed in having it removed from tomorrow's agenda so that they can look into this matter further. However, I want to emphasize this is critical legislation. It's in the best interest of our nation's economic prosperity to bring it to the full Senate. Therefore, I intend to include it in a future markup and ensure that the Senate is permitted to debate these issues fully. Senator Hollings.
Mr. Chairman, the problem is not increasing the tax burden. The problem is decreasing the tax burden at the local level. Everyone would agree not to tax the access to the Internet, and I don't know of anybody that suggested taxing access to the Internet. But what has really occurred is in a pell-mell rush to identify the technology, everyone is running around, ooh, I've done something. One individual, of course, said he invented the Internet, and others all hastening to try to identify with the technology, saying, I'm against, I'm for moratorium, we got to save the Internet, acting like the Internet is some sick chicken or needs Viagra. Heck, we got a runaway animal here. You don't have to worry about saving the Internet. I mean, even the Chinese out there trying to block it can't do it. So let's don't get on to this bit about increasing the tax. The problem is decreasing the tax. I had the privilege of working with Charles Conlon of the Federation of Tax Administrators in Chicago back in 1949 and 50 when we wrote the sales tax. It was a sales and use tax. Incidentally, we more or less used the California and Ohio laws, and they've never been disturbed, never really attempt to repeal it in the conservative legislature of South Carolina or otherwise set it aside at the court level. Now, it says use in all the states except 2 or 3 have just that, the use tax. So that if I buy a jacket from L.L. Bean in Freeport, Maine, if I order it on the telephone, if I order it by a letter, if I order it by an Internet, I'm subject to the use tax because it's bought in Maine for use in South Carolina. The problem, of course, has been over the years that the bureaucracy entailed in trying to collect that use tax far exceeded any kind of benefit, and so no one's bothered to really collect. On the other hand, with the volume of Internet sales, even Eddie, can't you see everybody buying their car on the Internet? That fella Heisinger, he's running around putting in these agencies all over everywhere. You can put every automobile dealer in your state and community out of business because they're just programmed, these big companies, General Motors, Ford, they just put the cars about 30 of them at the most. That's better than 130, because they require those dealers to program and some 130, and they just look at what you want, and we'll, the dealer itself, so to speak, will order it on the internet, and it'll be delivered the next day. And you save $500, $600 or whatever it is on a car, plus the, you know, added less expense, I should say, the less expense of actually programming all the automobiles out on the lot and that kind of thing. It's a trauma to local business and to the local revenue system. I had introduced a bill along that line that says, look, we used to have what we called revenue sharing. I had that in February of 1967. And we had it. It worked extremely well up until we and the senators up here were understanding that we were financing everybody at the local level to run against us. We said, wait a minute, we're giving them all the money and they're taking it, and they're running against us at the local level. And so with Howard Baker, myself, and others, we just eliminated the revenue sharing. But on that approach, or with that approach, we ought really to just give a service to the states. We could put in a 5%, waive the Interstate Commerce Clause, put in a 5% tax for the 50 states, and send it back to the states and let them fuss about the local and how they're going to divide it up or whatever it is. We don't have to charge the states anything, but we can lessen the impact of this new technology at the local level. That's the real problem. The real problem is not a moratorium. You can't tax the Internet. Nobody wants to tax access to the Internet. But it's the problem at the local level of trying to maintain what's left of Main Street. Walmart's done closed down half of it. This will close down the other half. And so what we need to do is look at what Senator Dogan and others have been working on. They know the tax system and what have you, and let's really provide a service for the states and get on with the problem and quit mounting these straw men like somebody's trying to ruin the Internet or interfere with the technology. You've got no chance of doing it. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stevens.
I don't have a prepared statement. I just want to endorse your statement, Mr. Chairman. I support this bill.
Thank you. Senator Wyden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Senator Hollings has identified the key issue, this question of the impact of technology on local revenue. And I'd just like to begin by offering up a few facts about what we have seen with respect to the impact on a local government since the Internet Tax Freedom Bill was passed. And in fact, I guess the New York Times summed it up this week when they said in a headline on page one, a resurgent Michigan leads newly flush states. The fact of the matter is that local revenue is way up since the Internet Tax Freedom Bill was passed. And in fact, in states where Internet usage is highest, local revenues are up the most. For example, California sales tax collections were up 20% over 1998. The traditional bricks and mortar retailers had one of their best holiday seasons. They had a nearly 8% jump in sales over the previous year. The states and localities ended fiscal 1999 with a $35 billion surplus. So this notion that technology is somehow devastating local revenues just is not borne out by the facts. The record clearly shows otherwise. Now the problems that states and localities are having with respect to collecting the sales and use taxes have nothing to do with the Internet. And in fact, the Internet Tax Freedom Bill, and I'm pleased that our co-author, Congressman Cox, is here today, he and I have pointed out, as the chairman has repeatedly, that there is nothing in the Internet Tax Freedom Bill that prevents a state from going out right now and putting in place a better and more cost-effective system of collecting sales and use taxes. But the states, as we have heard, won't do it because they don't want the political heat. Governor Scilucci of Massachusetts put it very well recently when he came to the Hill and said, I can't station a bunch of policemen on the Massachusetts border to run down folks coming over from New Hampshire and try and stick them with taxes. So what we now have is a situation where some of those who opposed us so vehemently in 1997, and I've gone back and looked at the record, it's an incredible record. The League of Cities, the National Association of Counties, and others said, and I quote, that our moratorium would cause a virtual collapse in the state and local revenue base. They said, and I quote, one of the gravest concerns of this new electronic era will be the almost complete erosion or potential implosion of the sales tax. So all these folks who were proven wrong in the years since the Internet Tax Freedom Act are now saying that what the Congress ought to do is let local jurisdictions go out and impose a new tax on a merchant 2,500 miles away from that jurisdiction who's got no connection with the jurisdiction other than a website. And that new tax ought to be imposed without a vote of the United States Congress. That's really what is at issue here. The Internet Tax Freedom Bill is about technological neutrality. It says that you can do anything you want to the Internet as long as you do unto the offline world what you do to the online world. So I'm anxious to work with these mayors and governors and others who opposed us in 1997, oppose us now as we try to extend the moratorium. But I think at some point, those who keep predicting these parades of horribles as a result of technology and our legislation have some obligation to offer a factual foundation for their position. Because those who predicted these dire consequences in 1997, I'd really urge my colleagues to look at the transcript because it is extraordinary in terms of what they predicted. What we have seen is just the opposite. Record-setting revenues in places where Internet usage is highest. And now these folks would like to go out and impose these new taxes without even a vote of the United States Congress. So this is an important hearing, Mr. Chairman. I've talked with Senator Dorgan and others. I'm anxious to try to find some common ground so we can move rapidly to a markup. We ought to extend at a minimum the ban on discriminatory Internet taxes. In fact, so that there would be clarity this time, Congressman Cox and I, in introducing our legislation, have renamed the bill. It's called the Internet Non-Discrimination Act, so as to make it clear.
It's a much better name.
I hope. And I look forward to our testimony, and I have a full statement that I would just ask that be part of the record, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator Wyden. Thank you for your informed and a very passionate effort on this very important issue. Senator Abraham.
Senator McCain, I'll be brief. I, as you know, I'm a co-sponsor of your legislation. I would just make the observation today that I made a couple of weeks ago in the Budget Committee when we heard from several governors and others talking about this issue, and that is that I believe that the ability today to predict the tax system of 5 or 10 years from now is very minimal. I believe that the changes in behavior with respect to the way people live their lives, buy things for their home, purchase goods and services, run their companies and so on, will be so dramatically affected by the high technology information age transition that we're going through that what we are debating today will, I predict, in 5 or 10 years seem to be a relatively innocent and somewhat perhaps even amusing debate in retrospect. I think that the Internet and the changes that technology and the information age bring to human behavior will force tax reform in ways that think tanks, that political candidates, all of us combined, in fact, have been unable to accomplish because of the changes that will happen in society. I question, for example, as the introduction of broadband and high-speed internet access becomes universal, how many companies will continue to build skyscrapers to house their employees under one roof. I believe we'll see dramatic changes in the number of people who, in fact, work out of their homes. I think we'll see changes in a variety of other ways that affect commercial transactions. And as we pass legislation such as our e-signatures bill, we'll see changes brought about by that as well. And so while I do support the legislation, I just would say that I suspect we'll be having many more hearings to address the issues of changes that technology brings about with respect to taxation and other various areas of government activity. I look forward to it. I think it's very exciting, and I'm sure under your leadership we will continue to be on the cutting edge of these issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Dorgan.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I support the moratorium, supported the legislation that called for it, although I must say to my colleague that had we passed the legislation as originally written and introduced, we wouldn't have much of a tax base in local governments for consumption taxes. But it was changed dramatically. I support it, and I would support its extension as well. But I think its extension needs to be accompanied by a series of considerations. Now, this explosion of information technology and the Internet is exciting, dynamic, and wonderful for our economy, and I agree that we should not have a tax system that would impose burdens upon it or injure it or injure the growth of this new exciting part of our economy. But having said that, we have a series of questions we need to answer. There are some principles here that are important. One, despite all of the rhetoric, there is no new tax being discussed by anyone. No new tax. On these transactions, there is a use tax that a consumer has a responsibility to report to the state in which they made in which the consumption occurred. Of course, that use tax is seldom ever paid. It's far too complicated. They have tens and tens of millions of Americans filing use tax returns. So the sales tax is generally the complementary piece of that, and the tax is collected upstream rather than downstream. Now, my colleague seems to suggest the states just don't have the wherewithal or the will to go out and collect this. That would suggest that he is proposing an army of more government agents and inspectors. I mean, I want less government, not more government. If you really want a use tax collected from tens and tens of millions of people through some regime, then you're talking about more government, more complexity. I'm talking about less government and simplicity. A tax exists on these transactions. The question is, how will it be collected? I think it's in our interest to find a simplified method, a very simplified method, simple for those who are internet sellers. I think every state ought to be required to have one blended rate, only one, and a tax system, a tax base that is common. One rate, a common base. That's simplification. Second, I think you have to be concerned about preserving a local tax base. Our schools are predominantly funded by the local tax base, and especially with the consumption tax, and I think you have to be concerned about that in the long run. And third, I think there is a significant issue with respect to fairness to Main Street merchants with respect to the obligation of a tax on a transaction. So, all of these things need to be part of the balanced approach that we take. Again, I support Senator McCain, an extension of the moratorium. Moratorium on discriminatory taxes makes eminent good sense. I support the prohibition on taxes on access. But I do think there needs to be more considered with respect to the other items I just discussed. And I want to end again by saying that no one is talking about a new tax. No one. There is no new tax involved. There is a consumption tax in this country that has complementary sales and use taxes. When a sales tax doesn't apply, a use tax does. But to suggest somehow to find a way to simplify the collection of a use tax as representing a new tax burden on the American people is just wrong, just not accurate. So I hope that we can work together and find a way to resolve this and do it as we did a year and a half ago with respect to the bill we passed the Senate. If I may make one additional short comment, we put together a commission in that piece of legislation, and in my judgment, the commission has failed. I understand that even though we provided that they would not make recommendations without a two-thirds recommendation on the commission, that there is going to be a report filed, but I think this commission largely has not achieved the goals that we would have liked, and perhaps we need to find some other way of doing that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for elevating this hearing to a full committee. I think it warrants full committees. I'm going to offer my statement for the record and add my name as a co-sponsor. I think it's what we've done so far has worked very well, and I think we ought to continue this, and I'm looking forward to hearing from the witnesses.
Thank you. Your statement will be made part of the record without objection. Senator Breaux.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Also, thanks for having the hearing at the full committee level. I think it's important enough. Let me just obviously make my position very clear from the outset. I think that Congress should give the states the authority to require the collection of a sales tax by businesses who sell products into a particular state over the Internet or any other means that they see fit to do so. I think that there is something patently wrong with a situation that allows a person to walk downtown to Main Street and buy a pair of shoes and pay the locally imposed sales tax on that transaction, which in most cases, as Senator Dorgan has said, goes to run the police protection, the fire protection, the schools within that local community. And yet somehow that person buys the same pair of shoes, ordering it out of state over the Internet, that he somehow escapes the legal liability of having the sales tax collected by the seller of the merchandise. It doesn't make any sense, and I think it is wrong. Congress should act in this area. I congratulate Mike Leavitt and others who served on the commission, having some experience with being on a commission that requires a super, super majority. I know how difficult that happens to be, if not impossible, to ever accomplish, but the work that they did, it was very helpful, and it shows that there's a real interest in solving this problem. I would suggest that it's not a question of whether sales tax increased on a local level last year. It's a question of what are they going to do in 5 years or 10 years or 20 years. I mean, of course, in the booming economy, sales taxes were up in most states. Mine was an exception. It was not up. And as more and more people look at this as a loophole to escape paying local sales taxes, in 5, 10, 15, and 20 years, you're going to see a system that does wreak real hardships on local communities because of Congress's failure to act to allow the imposition of what the local communities have already legally decided was an appropriate sales tax. As far as the connection, I mean, it seems to me that the only connection that the companies have outside of a particular state is a pipeline directly into the state sucking out money out of local communities. I mean, they certainly have the right to sell their merchandise. They have a huge advantage because they're not located there. They don't hire people there. They don't pay property taxes. They don't own buildings. Most times they don't contribute to local charities and being involved in local activities. They have a huge advantage selling in a local community. Why say that they're going to carve out a special exemption and allow them to get away with not having to pay the local sales tax and the local people in that community has said is appropriate and proper and is imposed upon themselves for important functions like schools and police protection and fire protection? Congress should act on this. I think a two-year moratorium was appropriate. We should figure out a universal state sales tax so that one tax could be collected and submitted to the state, and the state would distribute it to the local communities based on what is appropriate under the state rules and laws. Thank you.
Senator Hutchison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your holding this hearing. Certainly, I think the commission that was put together has looked at this issue very carefully. But it is a crucial issue for a state like mine that doesn't have a state income tax. I spilled some blood in my state to avoid having a state income tax. And if we allow this inequities to continue to occur, I can well see that we are not going to have the sales tax base that will support our state, and I can see a drumbeat beginning for a state income tax, which I am going to fight to the death. So I hope that we can take a responsible step. I'm not sure that I agree with my colleague from Louisiana that collecting a sales tax nationally is the answer. That's what I had hoped this commission would bring forward in a plan that would be something that would be fair.
Well, the gentleman is addressed on that point. I didn't intend
witnesses. The senator from Louisiana is not recognized.
Well, she has the time. If she wants to yield, she can yield.
No, she does not. She's making an opening statement.
Well, she could yield on an opening
statement. I rule the senator from Louisiana out of order. That's the ruling of the chair. Please complete your opening statement so that we can go forward with the witnesses.
Can you yield on her time?
Time is for opening statements, I say to the senator from Louisiana. I thank the senator from Louisiana for his courtesy.
Let me say that perhaps I shouldn't have mentioned a disagreement. We will have time to debate at another time. But I do believe that it is important for us to find the right answer. At the very least, we shouldn't have retail sales be treated differently on the Internet than they are in catalogs. And states have been able to pass laws that would require the collection of a sales tax from a consumer in a state if there is a catalog purchase. I think we've got to look at this issue very carefully. I don't think we should tax the Internet itself, but I think the issue of a level playing field where a retailer pays taxes and supports the community and should not have an unfair competitive disadvantage because you can buy something without paying a sales tax on a retail purchase from an Internet company. So I think we have a very tough issue that we want to go into the new economy, but we also need to realize that we have certain services that are done at the state and local level that are supported by retailers who invest in the community and by consumers who pay a sales tax. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate having this hearing. I hope we can do something responsible that does keep a level playing field for all of the businesses in our country.
Senator Bryan?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. In the interest of time, let me say that I associate myself with some of the observations made by our distinguished colleague from Texas. I think the growth of the Internet has been a very positive thing for us in the country. I think it's helped to spawn a technology explosion that will put us well ahead of our competitors in the 21st century. Having said that, as a former governor, I am concerned about what the implications are for tax bases in state and local governments who are heavily dependent upon sales tax collections. In my own state, one-third of the revenue derived to operate all the essential services of government, primarily education in the state, are dependent upon the sales tax. So I think we do have to look in terms of how we treat this issue, in no way to penalize or to limit the opportunities for expansion, but to deal with the very legitimate concerns that state governments have. The second thing I have is this inherent sense that there ought to be some equity and fairness. I mean, for many communities in my own state, and I'm sure for that of my colleagues as well, local businessmen and women in Main Street America really form the hub and base of so much of what we do, whether it's the support of the Little League or the Boy Scouts, the Girl Scouts, the Campfire Girls, are done as a result of the involvement civically by those individuals who are active in the business community. It seems to me that they're entitled in any kind of a system to be treated fairly and equally. And so I think there's an equity issue at all as well. And so I would hope that we might be able to address those two issues. And again, I thank the chair for convening this very timely and important hearing.
Thank you very much. I'd ask the Honorable Christopher Cox, the U.S. House of Representatives, and the Honorable Mike Levitt to come forward. Congressman Cox, would you make your statement and followed by Governor Levitt? Welcome to both of you before the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Thank you for inviting me to testify this morning as a co-author of the Cox-Wyden legislation, more popularly known as the Internet Tax Freedom Act, and I certainly appreciate the opportunity to join my co-author. It was this committee, your committee, Mr. Chairman, that held the first ever hearing on the issue of the microphone a little closer, please, on the issue of Internet taxation. I'm also joined this morning at the witness table by the distinguished governor of Utah, Governor Mike Leavitt, who served on the Internet Tax Commission created by the Internet Tax Freedom Act. And it was with Governor Leavitt that I spent many, many long hours a few years ago writing the legislation that created not only the commission but also the existing moratorium. We brought together very different points of view from state governments, from local governments, from many municipalities all over the country, and we agreed on one very, very important principle, and that is that the Internet should not be singled out for special taxation, for multiple taxation, or for discriminatory taxation. It's important to get straight what the Internet Tax Freedom Act is, and therefore what your bill, Senator McCain, which is co-authored by Senators Wyden, Abraham, and Leahy of this committee, does when it extends that existing moratorium. Just 3 years ago, our purpose was to prevent a tyranny of the parochial over the Internet, which is not just national in scope, but global. There were already afoot, a few years ago, incipient efforts by some 30,000 potential taxing jurisdictions in this country alone to lay claim to a piece of the net. There were news articles that talked to us about efforts by state and local governments to shake down the net. People viewed this as a great cash cow that could be exploited, and perhaps exploited without notice. Internet access services were a big target. This was long before politicians grabbed the issue of the digital divide as something that they wanted to prevent. Rather, governments were talking about actually taxing Internet access. Multiple taxation was a big concern. That's because the Internet's very design, its packet-switched architecture, made it especially vulnerable to taxation by multiple jurisdictions. And discriminatory taxation was also a real threat. Just a few years ago, many academics, governments in Europe, and even the United Nations were talking, for example, about a bit tax, something specially designed to prey upon electronic commerce. It would have taxed every single bit, every zero and one of digital information in cyberspace, literally an information tax. The Internet Tax Freedom Act, which you are talking about extending here today, stopped such multiple discriminatory and technologically targeted taxation. That's exactly what it did. It ensured that the Internet's not caught up in this tyranny of the parochial in 30,000 taxing jurisdictions. What it did not do is protect Internet transactions from sales tax. That is an important issue that many people on this committee, that Governor Leavitt, many people across the country wish to discuss. That's not what this legislation is about. This legislation is about protecting the Internet from discriminatory taxation. And the two are very, very different. The Internet Tax Freedom Act doesn't create a preference for electronic commerce over bricks and mortar. The existing tax moratorium that this committee helped write doesn't even mention sales taxes. It stops multiple and discriminatory taxes on products ordered over the Internet, but it does not bar taxation of Internet commerce by states and local government. So whatever disagreements there might be on other aspects of this question, on sales taxes, for example, on nexus, on physical presence, on the Supreme Court's decisions, there ought to be, as a starting point, agreement on this principle of Internet non-discrimination. As we all know, the version of the Internet Tax Freedom Act that became law lasts only 3 years. That's why this legislation is important. The temporary nature of the moratorium was something that many of us thought was an important compromise because it would give us a chance to see what happened. And as Senator Wyden pointed out in his opening statements, there were concerns that we were going to sail off the edge of the earth, that everything would fall apart, that there would be a big fall off in revenues. That didn't happen. As we meet here today, not only is it true, as Senator Breaux said, that of course the economy is doing well and tax collections are up, but I think most economists are willing to tell us that the reason we are enjoying this prosperity is the new economy. we have it to thank for the federal government, for state governments, and for local governments being awash in new tax revenues. So far from the cataclysm in tax collections that was predicted by preventing discrimination against the Internet, and that's what this committee did, we have protected and promoted the collection of taxes by state and local governments and by the federal government. Brick-and-mortar sales aren't down, they're up, and they're way up. The International Council of Shopping Centers reports that 1999 holiday sales, the most recent holiday season, were up 8%. Now, 8% growth in a mature industry that is enormously bigger than e-commerce is quite spectacular. The Internet has helped traditional retailers expand beyond Main Street to sell to new markets. Tax collections by state and local governments, in part in consequence of this explosion in traditional commerce, are also way up. In my state of California, sales tax collections 1999 over 1998 are up 11%, and for the fourth quarter they're up 20%. The growth in Internet commerce and taxable sales has fattened state budgets, which ended fiscal 1999 with a combined $35 billion in state surpluses. And the federal government is a big beneficiary of this as well, even though we collect no sales taxes. Total federal tax collections, as a result of the economic growth spurred by this new economy, were up $118 billion, 1999 over 1998. So I think the facts are in. We have learned from this moratorium. The results are conclusive. The new economy is generating tremendous new revenue. The current tax policy is working, and it ought to be extended. It's working not only for states, not only for the federal government, but for counties and for cities whose power to tax has been protected by this legislation, but the national interest at the same time has also been protected, and the global interest in this new medium of exchange has also been protected. I'd like to conclude with a brief anecdote, if I might. About a century and a half ago, Michael Faraday became world-renowned for his invention of the first electric motor, the dynamo. He did this by rotating a current-bearing wire around a magnet. His invention came to the attention of the king, William IV, and he got an audience with the king, and Faraday described and demonstrated his invention, upon which the king said to him, "This is interesting, but of what use is it?" And Faraday replied, "Only time will tell, but of this I'm certain. Someday, sir, you will tax it." We are here today to discuss new ways to tax Faraday's invention. I hope that this committee will be wise in exercising that responsibility, because the art of taxation has been compared wisely, I think, to plucking a goose. The object is to get the most amount of feathers with the least amount of squawking. If we want to protect this extraordinary expansion in federal, state, and local revenues that we're experiencing, we'd be wise to tread lightly in this area. I want to thank the committee for your patience and your interest and attention to this issue.
Thank you very much, Congressman Cox. Governor Leavitt, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one housekeeping item. The testimony that I submitted to the committee, as I reviewed the formal testimony, I recognized that a portion of that testimony was drawn not directly from my words, but from a group of words that were part of the Advisory Commission on e-commerce, and I'd just like to acknowledge that, and I'll submit a correction so that it's clear. I'd like to begin by just echoing what I've heard around the room today, and that is that the Internet's the most powerful force of expansion that this planet's ever known economically. I'd like to acknowledge the fact that Congressman Cox and I did work long hours, and that the Internet Tax Freedom Act was a bill that I supported and the governor supported. We believe fervently then and do now that there should be no bit tax. There should be no bandwidth tax, no access tax, no multiple tax, no discriminatory tax. The Internet itself simply should not be inhibited in any way with tax policy on its growth. This debate, I believe, will focus really around three issues. The first is, what should the relationship be between the state and the national government? Who ought to be making decisions on this and important issues related to education and roads and schools, and how does the Internet change that? Second, is the sales tax going to be a viable tool in the 21st century? It might not be. we might find out that it's because of the nature and changes that occur in the way we transact business that it may not be viable. I would suggest unless we make some substantial changes, it probably won't be, and we need to begin to think about what the consequences would be in a legal try to accept them. The third issue is if we are to have a sales tax, will we adopt a philosophy that will create a level playing field where all sellers and all buyers are treated the same, or will we adopt a philosophy that says we're going to grant a special privilege to certain segments of our economy not to have to contribute to our schools or our roads or our law enforcement? As Congressman Cox pointed out, the existing moratorium is something that had my support and continues to have my support. It is at the proper time. I'd be very optimistic and pleased to see it extended. We still have 18 months left on the moratorium. There's a lot of things that have changed even since we enacted the first moratorium, the whole area of telephony, how we're going to deal with that. Many of those issues are just now emerging, and the next 18 months will be an important time for us to be able to analyze those. But I'd be very optimistic and willing to see it extended. I'd like to comment briefly, Mr. Chairman, on the Advisory Commission on Electronic Commerce. As was pointed out, we were not able to achieve the two-thirds that was required in order to put forward a report. A report is being advanced, but it did not attain the statutory requirement. I feel some disappointment in reporting what I believe to be a lack of success unnecessarily in the Commission's efforts. We were so close to what I think could have been a powerful statement of direction and recommendation to the Congress. I'd like to review with you the things on which we had virtual agreement on. Out of 10 major areas, we had expressive agreement on 8 of the areas. We simply had disagreement on 2, and I'd like to highlight both the agreements and the disagreements. The first was our general acknowledgement of the power of this engine of economic expansion and that we ought to do nothing to inhibit it. We all agreed on that. The second was that there should be no discriminatory taxes, no new taxes placed on the Internet. Both, all agreed, both of those who voted in the majority and those who were not voting on the side of the majority. We agreed in our first meeting, 15 out of 19 commissioners, that the ultimate goal needed to be a level playing field. We also agreed that unless we had radical simplification, harmonization of the existing system, that it simply wouldn't work in the 21st century. The current system is a mess, and if it isn't fixed, it will not be compatible with the economy of the 21st century. We agreed that the telecommunications industry was dramatically overtaxed as an industry, and that the tax system we had was far too complex and needed to be simplified. We agreed that these should all be revenue neutral, that we were not in any way attempting to impose requirements on the Internet that would make it a tax collection vehicle, that anything we do should be revenue neutral. We also agreed that it should be zero burden to seller, that if we did not meet the requirement of being able to essentially make this a zero burden to those who have to use the Internet as a collection means, that the sales tax likely would not be a viable vehicle in the 21st century. We agreed that there needed to be protection for small firms, that the tender shoots of commerce that are coming up through the soil ought to receive some kind of special protection, perhaps in the form of some sort of a de minimis rule, where small firms would not have to be burdened with in any way, but that once they reach a certain point, that in fact they ought to become full citizens and meet the requirements of corporate citizenship. Now, what are the areas in which we did not agree? There were two. First, that the national government should preempt the capacity of state and local governments to control their own tax policy. The report clearly indicated that they should. We disagree with that. And second of all, that there should be some form of special tax privileges granted. We believe in a level playing field. So those are the only two areas in which there is disagreement. Now, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to submit for the record today a letter from 40 governors in this country asking that the conclusions of the report be rejected, given the fact that they clearly call for preemptions of state authority, and second of all, that they would not create a level playing field.
I'd also like to submit a letter from 170 of the country's most respected academic tax experts who indicate that there is no rational basis to pursue a tax policy that does not include as its foundation a level playing field. And I would like to submit, if you would allow, a copy of the report drafted by a minority on the commission. Where do we go from here?
Without objection, all those documents will be included in the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The states are pursuing actively and aggressively, through the Uniform Commission on State Laws, the creation of a model state law that would standardize, harmonize, and modernize the sales tax system. It would be our hope that in the next 2 years we could come to Congress and ask them to authorize the creation of an interstate compact that states would have the option of moving into that or facing certain privileges that would not be accorded them. We also believe that this can lead us, this is a pathway to a level playing field. Now, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just conclude today by making reference to a piece of legislation that the President recently signed that came from you as the Chairman. I think it's a tribute to your leadership, and that is the Airport Investment and Reform Act of the 21st century. I would like to say in particular, there's one thing I like as a fellow Westerner who has to travel from the West and endure that 1 hour drive from Dulles Airport. Thank you for the flights going into Nashville. That will be a great...
thank you very much.
It will be a great benefit to many of us. But the legislation also clearly included an increase on sales taxes collected over the Internet. The taxes, it would have been a terrible imbalance if it had not. There wasn't a single senator who stepped up to offer an amendment that would have changed that. It would have dramatically reduced the mechanism for collecting funds that go to improve airports that we all depend on. I can just imagine the fuss that would have been caused if suddenly state legislatures started passing laws saying you cannot collect taxes on the Internet with respect to airport or to airline tickets. The Congress would have rushed to the Supreme Court saying that's a violation of interstate commerce, and they would have been right. They would have said, you're not allowing us to collect the dollars that are necessary from the proper people who are using it to pay for those services. It would have been seen as anti-internet. It would be seen as pro, if the states were saying it's anti-internet and pro-tax to be doing that. And I'd like to suggest we're talking about the sales tax in the same way. This boils down to just a couple of things. One, nobody likes taxes, but if we're going to have them, they at least ought to be fair. And second, the question of whether or not the sales tax is going to be a viable tool in the 21st century. If it is not, we need to begin to look at what the alternatives are. They are very clearly more income taxes and property taxes, consequences I don't believe the people of this country are prepared to accept. And the third, where are we going to control basic decisions about our schools and our roads and our law enforcement? Those are traditionally and very clearly local prerogatives and best managed at the local level, and this issue very much reflects the question of whether or not local communities will continue to be able to do so. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Governor Leavitt. The moratorium runs out in about 16 months. And do you have some confidence that this model state law can be agreed upon in that period of time?
I feel very confident that we're going to be able to have the model legislation developed and before the Congress for the authorization of an interstate compact. Now, if sufficient progress has not been made by that time, then I think the Congress clearly ought to make a decision based in that framework. It may be that we'll get to that point and conclude that a lot of the progress has been made. And at that point, we would extend the moratorium. I'd be in support of that.
I believe you stated that you supported the first moratorium.
I did, in fact, yes.
We received letters from the National Governors Association and many governors. Did you weigh in at that time?
I think Congressman Cox would recognize, in fact, we did. We had grave concern about the first version of the moratorium, which very clearly would have ended local control of the sales tax as we know it today. Gratefully, substantial changes were made. We became not just comfortable with the moratorium, but supportive of it.
seems to me you are going to apply one rate of sales tax to internet transactions and a different rate to local in-person transactions. Is what your model leads to. Is that correct?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily?
No, we're interested in being able to come up with a level playing field.
That every state in America is going to adopt that same model? Please, Governor.
There are many, Senator, there are many instances where that's occurred already. The fuel tax is one example. We have a model already where each state collects, and there's a process through which the states have cooperated. This is an issue that the states have grave interest in, and it's very clear to me that when the interstate compact goes on the table, that there's going to have to be incentives for the states to do it, some of them positive, some of them negative. But the states will act, and if the states don't, Mr. Chairman, then I believe the Congress should. But the states, in fact, I believe will act and just need some time to pull this together. This is a problem that the states have to solve.
What progress have the states made in the area of taxation of mail order catalog sales?
The states, I would suggest that Congress has not made much progress in the collection. If the states were allowed, they would have done very well.
Mr. Chairman? I wonder if I might comment on this. I mentioned in my remarks that the Internet Tax Freedom Act itself does not address sales taxes. Any concerns about the collection of sales taxes or the counterpart to sales taxes, use taxes, are a function not of the Internet Tax Freedom Act, not of the existing moratorium, which only prevents new taxes and discriminatory taxes and multiple taxes, but rather of Supreme Court decisions. What those Supreme Court decisions have decided, first in 1967 and then in 1992, can essentially be described in plain English as no taxation without representation. States have jurisdiction over the people who live there, and they can tax them. States do not have jurisdiction over people who do not live there, and they cannot tax them. Therefore, if someone is doing interstate commerce, they are subjecting themselves to tax by entering the state. And what the Supreme Court has said is that if you mail something into the state, that's not enough. If you set up business there, and you have people there, well, then that's different. The principle of no taxation without representation is not violated if you are taxed. Are states left without recourse if they cannot collect a sales tax on a remote seller? Absolutely not. Every state in America that has a sales tax has a use tax, which is identical in every respect. The same rate, the same application, collected on the same transaction. So in economic effect, it's exactly the same. States can tax the purchaser. And the Internet, I submit, actually makes this possible in ways that it was not before. Now, I'm not a big fan of adding taxes to commerce, even sales taxes that support state and local governments, but that's not a matter of my personal predilection. As a matter of power, the states ought to have that power, and they do. But what we're being asked to do in Congress now is to change that federalism, to change that federal-state relation, and expand the power of states to tax so that the principle of no taxation without representation would be violated. That would be a terrible thing. So I agree with Governor Leavitt that states ought to have jurisdiction over the people who live there, over the transactions that take place in that jurisdiction. But that means that all they need to do is tax the transaction in exactly the same way that otherwise they would if it occurs on the Internet, by taxing the purchaser. That's the person over whom they have jurisdiction. The amount is the same as the sales tax. It looks and feels the same as the sales tax. Nobody would know the difference. I'm not encouraging the expansion of use taxes or use tax collection because I personally think it's nice to have a modest level of taxation. But as a matter of power, I can't disagree with the governor. States ought to have that power, and they do. And Congress shouldn't go any further and expand the power of states to collect taxes.
Mr. Chairman, may I just
yes, Governor, sure.
It is very clear to me, and I think to governors and state and local officials, that if we don't fix the existing tax system, that the capacity to collect the sales tax will not be there in the future. E-commerce is growing at such a rate, and we're encouraging it, doing all we can to encourage it to grow. It is growing at such a rate that ultimately, in order for people to be competitive, they're going to have to remain using e-commerce. And our purpose is simply to say this: set up a hurdle for us to meet. The hurdle is zero burden on sellers. If we can't create a system
where the burden is virtually zero on those who sell over the Internet, then it's likely that the sales tax is not a viable tool in the future because the field will no longer be level, and those who ultimately sell with bricks and mortar will be so disadvantaged that ultimately we will be required by fairness and economic policy to eliminate the sales tax altogether. And that may be where we want to go in this country, but if it is, we need to analyze what the consequences are. The senator from Texas has indicated very clearly what they would be in Texas.
Senator Burns. Yes, sir.
I have one question, I guess, through this whole thing and what you agreed on and what you did not agree on.
What do we do, Governor, with states who have no sales taxes, and I live in one of those states?
We would simply, under the proposal that we're making, we would simply have a standardized national system, and Montana, which does not have a sales tax, would simply be able to say, we don't impose it, we don't collect it, we would have a zero rate, it would have no impact on you. I will point out that the majority report that was issued by the commission would have quite an impact on Montana because it would have interfered with your capacity to collect income and property tax from certain vendors. It would have made the playing field unlevel in those areas, but it would have no impact on sales tax.
That's the only question I have, Senator Wyden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Both of you have been very helpful. And Governor, let me start with you. There is not a word in the Internet Tax Freedom Act that prevents Utah or any other state from going on out today and improving its system of collecting sales and use taxes. And I think we agree on that. Governor Cellucci came and he told us, the reason we don't do it is because there's too much political heat. I can't track people down running from New Hampshire. Same is true in the state of Washington. My friend Senator Gorton is here. They could go out and collect these taxes that are owed. They don't do it because of the political heat. Now, you all have come forward with a proposal for simplifying taxes. I don't happen to think it's very workable, but I'm anxious, again, to try to find common ground. And supposing we go forward with a markup in committee next week that looks like this. We extend the moratorium on discriminatory taxes on the Internet. I'd like to make it permanent. Maybe we say 5 years. We'll work with you on the time. But we also say we direct NCUSL, or one of the other groups involved in the state and local tax area, to work with the governors and the mayors and the cities on the proposal for tax simplification. And we would commit to giving you all a vote within, say, 180 days of the time NCUSL comes forward with the recommendation. So that way we could have a debate about whether it's actually workable. I don't think you all have come up with something that's workable yet. Maybe there is a technological fix out there that wouldn't impose any burdens on remote sellers. So supposing we went to a markup next week with those two provisions at the heart of the legislation, an extension of the moratorium on discriminatory taxes on e-commerce. And by the way, Governor Engler came to another committee and told me he'd support a permanent ban on discriminatory taxes on e-commerce. We have that on the record. So we'd make that the first provision in the bill, but then we'd say we direct NCUSL or some other group that you all feel comfortable with to go forward with their tax simplification proposal, and the Congress commits to giving you an up or down vote after we have the hearings and look at whether it's workable, and we pass that legislation out of this committee in the next few weeks. What's your reaction to that?
Senator, as you know, I did support and continue to support moratoriums on discriminatory taxes on the Internet. We have 18 months left on the existing moratorium. We are very anxious to bring to Congress model legislation, having been developed by NCUSL, that could form the basis of an interstate compact. That interstate compact would be the solution put forward that you're looking for. I'm the first to tell you, if we can't come up with that system,
not only do I believe we will not be able to collect the remote sales tax, I believe within a period of 3 to 5 to 7 years that the sales tax as we know it will no longer be a viable tool. The point is the states have an enormous incentive to get this fixed. Now, we need to put the fix up. The states need to put the fix up. And if we can't, then we need to get on with the analysis of the alternatives. This is clearly on the plate of the states and local governments. If we can't fix this system, and it's a mess, then the sales tax as we know it will not be a viable tool in the 21st century.
So what would be wrong with our moving forward with what I propose? You all have already said that you're not for discriminatory taxes on e-commerce, so that would be the first plank. And second, we would commit to giving you all a vote. You'd get the votes that you wanted in the Congress on your proposal. What would be wrong with going forward with that?
We went down that road before, and it became very clear, and I think it's no one knows better at this table, that part of the moratorium was the incentives that it created for everyone to come to the table and solve the problem. It also became very clear that the assurance of a vote could not be enforced under Senate rules and certainly in the House, and it was far too complex to be able to see that as the solution. What we're proposing is we want to have a couple of years to bring back a solution. If we can't, our world is not going
Governor, we can write into a law a fast-track process that commits to a vote. And I guess what troubles me is I'm trying to reach out and extend the olive branch to y'all. Y'all were proven wrong in 1997. And it wasn't just before the bill that you all predicted all of these problems. There has been a drumbeat ever since the enactment of the law about how this is going to erode all these revenue bases. I can't find one state, not one in America, that has seen its sales tax base eroded as a result of the Internet Tax Freedom Act. And your reluctance to go along with something that I think is at least trying to meet you halfway is an indication that what you all really want, the real goal here, is frankly to let the moratorium expire, then we'll let all these jurisdictions go out and start doing their own thing. And to me, that undermines your view that you all really are committed to a non-discriminatory approach on e-commerce. So I hope that you will work with us on this, because I think that Chairman McCain and I and others on both sides of the aisle would like to find common ground. But we are not going to let you, like grease going through a goose, subject these out-of-state, you know, remote sellers to new what appear to be bureaucratic requirements for collecting taxes without our having at least a chance to examine it. We ought to have a chance to examine it, and what I'm offering to you, I think, shows a reasonable common ground position that I hope you'd look at.
Senator, let me respond. First of all, we are sincere, and we're sincere in our support in support of the moratorium, and we'll continue to be so. But I think it's important that we recognize that when we started talking about a moratorium in 1997, it was not the same moratorium we're talking about today, period. And it would have had every consequence that was pointed out by state and local government then, and it would now. Now, this is a good economy. The states have had an average increase in the growth of their tax revenues of 5.2%. The federal government, I might add, has had one of 7.7% during that exact same period. Now, I pointed out earlier that members of the Congress and the President supported the bill I suggested on national airports. It included a clear increase in Internet taxation. I didn't see a single United States senator stand up and say, let's not tax the Internet on this one, because you needed the revenue and you wanted to have a system that was balanced and provided a level playing field. That's all we're asking for here. Give us a chance to fix a system that is dramatically broken and that will not be compatible with the 21st century. We're reaching out saying we'll bring the solution to the table. If we can't, let's all recognize we've got to get on to the next option, which is property tax and income tax.
I just offered you a proposal that's in line with what you say you all support, that you say you're for a ban on discriminatory Internet taxes. That's what Governor Engler said. You've said that you would support an extension of the moratorium on Internet taxes. I've just offered you a proposal that's a middle ground, and
Senator Wyden, can I
ask one other additional question?
Yes, but please make it brief for the other members, and we have another.
You've got a seller 2,500 miles away from a local jurisdiction. They have no presence in that local jurisdiction other than a website. They use no services. They don't have plants. They don't ask water permits. They don't have anything. All they have is a website. How do you envisage that person getting a fair shake under your proposal?
First of all, the tax isn't on the Internet seller. It's on the person who lives in the state who does use the sewer and the roads and the water. The issue isn't the question of whether or not the tax is owed. It's a matter of who do we place the burden on to collect it. And I would say if we put a burden on a new firm that doesn't have the capacity and sophistication to do it, that would be wrong, and we ought to have a de minimis rule that says if you're not above a certain level of sophistication and size, you're not subject to it. Second of all, I would say if we ultimately put any kind of a substantial burden on any business, be it Kmart, Target, or a new business, then the system won't work. And if we can't bring back a system that essentially creates zero burden to those who have to collect it, we will have failed. The sales tax will not only be unviable on remote sales, but it's going to be unviable on general bricks and mortar, because this country will not stand for the kind of unlevel playing field that would be created where you can go into a store and buy one thing and go to a kiosk outside the store and buy it on the Internet and have taxes collected on one and not the other. It won't work.
Before I recognize Senator Gorton, sir, we have ample precedent for fast-track authority that requires a vote on an issue once it's legislated. You are incorrect in your response, and we don't have that kind of authority. Senator Gorton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I suspect that this is an issue on which almost every member of this panel, if not every member, has made up his mind, and I'd just like to make a couple of comments. One to my good friend, Chris Cox. I argued cases like this in the Supreme Court, Congressman Cox, and it is not true to say that the Supreme Court rule is no taxation without representation. That is a total distortion of the Supreme Court decisions. We tax the people of the District of Columbia without representation. Senator Wyden's state taxes my Washington residents without representation if they so much cross over the state line in the course of doing any of their work. The decision of the Supreme Court is that there's no taxation without presence, which is quite different from representation. And they have determined that a catalog seller in one state doesn't have a tax presence without Congress authorizing them to do so, which is why this issue is before us. It's also very clear from the Supreme Court that it would regard such an act of Congress as perfectly within our power over interstate commerce, and I think it's the implication of those decisions that we ought to do it. But we've just, in order to create the very fairness that Governor Leavitt is speaking about, I think we should be extremely cautious at setting policies for other people. Boy, is it easy for Congress to say that someone else shouldn't impose a tax. And that's what we're doing. Even with a moratorium, we're doing that. We're saying Congress should say someone else shouldn't impose a tax. But just yesterday, we voted on whether or not Congress ought to impose a tax that we collect and we spend. We had a vote on whether or not we ought temporarily to suspend a 4-cent gasoline tax, and we voted rather overwhelmingly against it. Why? Because members of the Senate got up and said, well, we can't do that. We won't be able to build roads if we don't continue to impose this tax. But evidently, we don't care whether or not states can fund schools. Now, in connection with what Senator Wyden had to say, of course the tax base has been eroded. It's been eroded to exactly the extent that sales take place, so without a sales or use tax being collected. We have states that are doing pretty well now and haven't directly suffered as a result of it, but their tax base has been eroded. presumably, in many of their cases, their sales taxes would be lower on everything if they had a broader base. And for anyone to say, well, it's perfectly easy, just collect the use tax on the resident when it arrives, that's been the law in the United States in every state with a sales tax for 50 or 100 years, and you can't, for all practical purposes, collect that use tax except on an automobile or something like that is so large that it has to be registered. And in my view, which is different from some of the others here in this connection, it's easy. Once a state has agreed that it's going to only impose a single rate of sales tax on all sales, there's no burden whatsoever in requiring the out-of-state seller to collect that from the buyer and submit it to the state. Personally, I think Governor Leavitt gives up too much in the argument that he makes to us here. But the answer to Senator Wyden is, those of us who believe in fair treatment, and I think the fairness to the retail sellers is the overwhelming argument here, not to mention the proposition that we shouldn't be determining state tax policies. The argument is overwhelming. If we have a vehicle that we can get a hearing on, we ought to use that vehicle. As Governor Leavitt says a little more politely than I do, but that's the beginning and the end of it. And this is a fascinating hearing, but I think members have made up their minds. If you're in a non-sales tax state like Oregon's, you're not losing a dime over telling Washington that it can't collect the tax when someone sells something from Oregon into the state of Washington. Doesn't cost you a dime. And I probably, if I were the senator from Oregon, I might very well take that point of view, but it isn't a fair one.
Would gentlemen yield?
Sure.
I'm taking the position on the Internet Tax Freedom Act for the same reason I worked with you on the Y2K liability legislation. This is what we need to grow the new economy, and I thank the gentleman.
We've got another year and a half before we have to do that. I agree with that. If Governor Leavitt's group has not come up with an answer by a year from now, then we ought to extend it. But it's perfectly appropriate to vote on both of these closely related issues at the same time. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for giving me a chance. I'm sorry. I was late. I should have said that earlier.
Thank you very much, Senator Gorton. Could I give both our witnesses a chance to respond to your comments before we move to Senator Dorgan?
I very much appreciate that because... I think, Senator Gorton, that you and I agree on some big principles, and that is the allocation of responsibilities between state and local governments. I come from Orange County, California, which has more people than 17 states and no senators. And so every time we send our money to Washington, we get shortchanged. We have to share our senators with 34 million others, and we recognize, for example, that when it comes to the gas tax, the 18.4 cent per gallon tax on gasoline that we pay to the federal government, that goes into the Federal Highway Trust Fund, and we have an expectancy that we're going to get roads built in Orange County, but good luck. Rhode Island, which has one-third the number of people as Orange County, gets as much or more money than we do. And that's
I have some affection for Rhode Island.
Particularly as a fiscal conservative, as a Republican, but also as somebody who lives in a place that gets cheated by this federal system on a daily basis, I don't want to send power, influence, and money to Washington. And I want the states and the city councils and the county supervisors where I live to have this authority. So I strongly agree with you. The reason that I co-authored the Internet Tax Freedom Act in the first place was that we have to recognize the possibility with the Internet of the tyranny of the parochial. I mean, there's too much of a good thing here. I want my local people involved, but I don't want the local city council in some neighboring state and all 50 states and the utility commissions and everywhere to be taking a piece of a transaction because electrons are moving through their state. That's the problem that the Internet presents to us. So all we've done is put together legislation that bans discriminatory taxes, multiple taxes, and new taxes. And what is being said here this morning is that everybody agrees on that. Yet some people are willing to take this bill, which would simply keep in place the ban on multiple and discriminatory taxes, take it hostage
and withhold support for what is right and for what they agree is fair so they can get a vote on something else, which is somewhat related. It's the same general topic. It's the Internet. But I don't think that on the merits anybody can object to a ban on new taxes, technologically targeted taxes, multiple taxes, or discriminatory taxes. Tell me which one anybody here is in favor of. I've heard none. No support for it. Lastly, insofar as the Supreme Court decisions are concerned, I think you recognize when I say no taxation without representation is at bottom what these decisions are about, that I don't believe that that sentence is written into the Constitution. Instead, those decisions were based upon Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, the Interstate Commerce Clause, and the earlier Bellis Hess decision, also on a separate ground, due process. But we have to ask ourselves, why is that Interstate Commerce Clause in the Constitution? Why did the framers fear discrimination by one state against residents of another?
Irish McCoy, had good reason to do so.
They had good reason to do so. And the essential genius of the Interstate Commerce Clause is that it gives the national government jurisdiction over preventing the tyranny of the parochial. That's all we're doing here. And that's a very, very important thing to uphold. And I didn't hear anything in your comments or any senator's comments or the governor's comments that argues the contrary, that we should somehow discriminate against electronic commerce. The Internet Non-Discrimination Act, which will move in the House on this bill, which is essentially the same thing, Senator McCain's bill, that many of you have sponsored, does only that. And these other issues that come up in 18 months, I think we also ought to take a look at and not confuse them. That is the fallacy of non sequitur.
Governor Levitt.
The Supreme Court, I think very simply said, can't expect 7,500 taxing jurisdictions to respond to all of these people and to respond to all of them. They said, either you bring back a system that has zero burden on sellers, or we're going to impose a limit on your ability to do that. And what we're proposing to do is to figure out that system, and if we can't, it's pretty clear we'll continue to suffer the same problem. I would like to just comment on one point you made that was related to Senator Wyden's. Let me do it by expressing a story. My mother is the grandmother of 29 grandchildren, and on a December morning last year, she came to my home on her way to the mall, and it was snowing, and she knew the crowds were going to be there, and she was reluctant, and I said, why don't you do it on the Internet? She never shopped on the Internet. So we sat down for an hour and a half, and she bought a gift for all 29 of her grandchildren. And not only, she was thrilled. She didn't have to fight the crowds. She didn't have and then they packaged them for her and mailed them to her grandchildren when she was done. Now, I kept track as we went through that just because of my own curiosity. I wanted to make sure my mother paid her use tax. There was $2,400 spent that day. And all but 400 of it was not subject to taxation. 400 of it was, because they had nexus in the state. Now, my mother would still owe that, and I'm confident she'll take care of it. But the point is this. People are not shopping on the Internet to avoid the sales tax. They're shopping because it's convenient, because it's a very good thing. And our economy is booming, yes, because of the new economy, but we shouldn't be making tax policy decisions on the basis of a temporary economic expansion. We ought to be dealing with tax policy that creates a level playing field that will endure forever. I invite anyone in this room who's made a purchase on the Internet to ask themselves, why did they do it? Did they do it because it was 1 o'clock in the morning and they didn't want to go to the mall and it wasn't open, or did they do it because they want to avoid the sales tax? I would submit to you that in your heart, it's pretty clear what it is.
Thank you, Senator Dorgan.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Governor Levitt, my colleague Senator Wyden and Congressman Cox indicated that the states should really just collect the use tax if they want to. Having been a tax administrator and actually administered a state sales and use tax, I can tell you it is impossible to collect the use tax on a broad basis. But as a governor, can you describe for me what kind of burden does this impose on the taxpayer, number one, and number two, what kind of additional employees would the state of Utah need to collect a broad-based use tax throughout the state of Utah?
Well, it's been impossible in the past, as the chairman pointed out, on remote sales of any sort to do that. It would be an imposition in many cases. We do, in certain cases where it can be tracked, collect a use tax, mostly on business.
But as you know, when you go to a catalog and it says if you live in the state of Maine or Virginia or Utah or South Carolina, you have to calculate it. It is being collected today, but only where there is a nexus. So we're doing our best, but what we're proposing is a system that would be zero burden to anyone. And it's not just zero burden to remote sellers. We think we can redesign the system to save billions of dollars in inefficiency, in friction that's currently in the system that can go to the benefit of the American economy and be a very substantial benefit to taxpayers.
My point was that if you did really try to collect the use tax across the board, you would have to hire thousands of people. You would impose new burdens on virtually all of your constituents because they'd have to file now individual use tax returns and declare a use tax on a small amount of goods they've purchased. So the point is, it is an impractical thing to do to say, well, let's just collect the use tax. That's not a solution. It's totally impractical.
As your neighbor, Governor Janklow, recently said, we'd have to start stopping men in brown suits and little brown trucks, and we'd have to hire armies of policemen, and it would be just impractical. It would be unreasonable. People would not accept it. It is not a solution.
And a better solution is one that has inherent simplicity and removes the burden effectively from the consumer and removes the burden from the seller, and that's what you're talking about. Let me ask a couple of additional questions. One, the contention is that, this really doesn't mean anything. The states have growing economies and are collecting more money. The Internet sellers, I'm told, last year sold $13 billion through the Internet in Internet sales, and it's expected in the next 10 years to grow to $1 trillion. Is there any reason that one can say this will not have an impact on the state sales tax or use tax base?
Those would argue that this is not going to be a burden or not going to affect states' capacity to deliver services, simply ignore reality. On one hand, we say we want it to grow without any inhibiting force. On the other hand, we say it's not going to have an impact. Those two are inconsistent. It is having an impact. I would challenge anyone to go to a state that has a sales tax, talk to the people who are estimating revenue, and despite the fact that in most states we are seeing increases, you will find that almost, well, that every tax commission who estimates revenue will have a category now for Internet sales. And it's a negative.
Now, Governor, you've heard discussion today of some here who said that there are people who want to impose new taxes, describing this debate. These are not new taxes, are they?
They are not new taxes, and that is political rhetoric.
Are you aware of anyone who wants to impose new taxes here?
I know of no one who wants to impose a new tax on the Internet. Among the governors, there may be a few, but we're not among them.
Congressman Cox, you indicated that prior to the moratorium that there were a range of governments, local governments, attempting to develop discriminatory taxes. So can you give us some examples of that?
Sure. Tacoma.
And what was Tacoma trying to do?
They were trying to levy a tax directly on Internet access.
And did they do that?
I believe that they were either successful in getting it started or we nipped it in the bud.
Are there a range of others?
Indeed. At the time, we had a website, the Internet Tax Freedom website, that can be accessed through my professional website, Cox, and it lists many of them.
I appreciate that.
And it wasn't really just the United States, as I mentioned. This is also something that's going on around the world.
One final question. Governor Leavitt, my understanding is that some of the largest retailers who are now going to be involved in Internet selling because they feel they must, from news reports, I'm told that they are intending to organize in a way and incorporate in a way that they will have an Internet sales component that will be able to sell without a responsibility to collect the local sales tax. If that occurs on a widespread basis, I assume that also will exacerbate the problem with the local tax base.
Major retailers in this country, and we're talking about the Walmarts and Kmarts who are perfectly capable of speaking for themselves, are clearly moving into a .com mode because it's the most efficient way of selling, and they should, and they will. They're suggesting, just give us a level playing field. Define the rules for us. It's very clear from their actions and as their word, they would prefer a level playing field. But if in this country we define the playing field as creating special privileges for a certain component of it, they will be forced by the competitive atmosphere in which they're in
to move to that point. They'll have kiosks outside of shopping malls, of stores. They'll hook their cash registers to the Internet. They'll find whatever ways they have to within the carve-outs that we define to move to that point. And that's the point I suggest, that the sales tax generally does not become viable. Or another thing occurs. People say, we cannot stand this inequity. We need to have a balanced system that's a level playing field, so let's have a national system. And the IRS will stand on their tiptoes and say, we're national, we'll collect it for you. And I'd be willing to bet there'll be those in Congress who say, if the IRS is collecting it, we ought to be appropriating it. And suddenly you would have revenues that have been collected and have been appropriated by state and local governments for schools and for roads and for law enforcement, will now be appropriated by the Congress and collected by the IRS, because the inequity, the inequality of one having to collect it and one not simply will not be allowed to stand in the long term.
I should point out that kind of federal tax is actually banned in the Internet Tax Freedom Act that we're trying to extend.
With respect to the genius of the Interstate Commerce Clause, the Interstate Commerce Clause actually is why we're discussing this. It gives Congress the authority to do this. And the other genius in the Constitution is that 640,000 North Dakotans have two senators.
That's one part of the Constitution that is not amenable, even under Article 5, the right of every state to have equal suffrage.
I want to work with Senator McCain, Senator Wyden, and Senator Brougham, our colleagues, to respond to this area. I support an extension of the moratorium. I support it for an eternity. I don't support discriminatory taxation, but I think there are other things we need to balance as we do this, and that's the reason for the questions. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Brough.
Mr. Chairman, thanks to witnesses. I apologize for having to leave, but I heard both of your testimony. We appreciate you being here. I have 2 points. I guess, Governor, I'd like to once again thank you for serving on that commission. It can be sometimes a thankless task, particularly when you have a two-thirds requirement to get an agreement. If we do extend the moratorium for 5 years or what have you, it would seem to me that it takes a great deal of the pressure off for you folks to come to any kind of a consensus or an agreement on what to recommend. Do you agree with that or do you disagree with that?
As I indicated, I supported the Internet Tax Freedom Act and the moratorium that's there, and I'm prepared to support its extension. I do believe we have 18 months, 16 or 18 months left on it. We have much to be done during that period. And
then if you are not able at that time, I take it your testimony, you'd support an extension, but at least give you the time to see if you can do it during this period.
In the last 12 months, we've seen dramatic changes. We'll see dramatic changes in the next 12, and I would suggest one of those will be that we'll start to see the clear shaping of a national model that could provide a zero-burden system for the development of the taxation on remote commerce.
I apologize if you have gone into detail on explaining this, but can you give me some indications so I can better understand what you all are attempting to do with regard to getting an agreement on a unified sales tax to be collected for Internet sales transactions? We're not talking about the Congress determining what each state's sales tax basis would be or amount would be, as I understand it. Can you give me some more elaboration on what you're recommending?
I think what you're asking me is, what would a zero-burden system look like if we were to be able to develop it? Well, we set a very high hurdle for ourselves. For example, it would have centralized one-stop registration. You wouldn't have to go to 50 different states. You'd go to one website, register, and you were registered in all 50 states. It would have uniform tax definitions, so that what was a peanut in one state would be a peanut in another. It would have uniform and simple sourcing rules. In other words, that we would have a standardized set of rules as to who was obligated to pay and who had the obligation to collect. We would have uniform exemption rules those that occupy who have tax-exempt status. It would do away with the tax audit as we know it. It would essentially have software that could be embedded in the software of a website that would completely eliminate and remove from the seller any responsibility for this. This would be a boon to those who are currently involved in commerce at the bricks and mortar level.
This recommendation, which you just described, would come to the Congress for Congress to take action on?
We would bring it to the Congress for them to authorize an interstate compact among the states. And with it, I believe, would be a group of
benefits for those who adopt it and some sanctions for those who don't. It's clear to me that the states have an enormous amount of incentive to adopt this. If we don't, we're going to be completely left behind, and the sales tax, as we know it, will no longer be a viable tool. We have to solve this problem.
What would the process be by which the states participate in making this recommendation?
The accusal process, which is the Uniform Commission on State Laws, each state sends representatives to the process, and they also bring with them, or they also include other stakeholders. They go through an exhaustive process to develop a model state law. It's then taken back to each state and passed in each state legislature as such.
The amount of each state sales tax under that recommendation could be different. It wouldn't be all necessarily all the same. I mean, Louisiana could have 5 cents, 5%. Texas could have whatever Texas has. California could have whatever under that.
There are those who argue that a single rate in every state would benefit. In my own state, in this last legislature, we authorized a single rate for remote sales. There are those who also argue that the technology will not make that necessary. Those who argue it wouldn't be necessary say that the technology exists today to be able to disseminate where it goes and that we ought to use the existing. That will be part of the debate that will occur in the next 2 years.
Okay. Well, I think you're attempting to accomplish something that is very, very helpful, obviously, to Congress. If we can get that type of a recommendation, I think that y'all have done terrific work, and we appreciate it. Chris, I appreciate your position, and we have some disagreements on it, but hopefully in the end we can come together and find a solution that everybody can work with. Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, would it be possible to ask one additional question?
Only one.
I ask it only because the point that Senator Breaux makes, I think, is right at the heart of our getting a bill out in the next few weeks. And my concern is if the moratorium ends without action, we can go back to letting all these local jurisdictions have at it. And my question would be, Governor Leavitt, if you support what you all say you're for, which is an extension of a moratorium on discriminatory taxes, I'll support your getting a vote on the fast track that the chairman was talking about of something I'm very skeptical of, which is you can come up with a workable system. Can you all look at that over the next few weeks and get back to the chairman and Senator Dorgan, Senator Breaux, and I, so that we can see if at least that can be examined?
We are always willing to talk, as both you and Congressman Cox know from our previous successful discussions that culminated in the Internet Tax Freedom Act.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you both for being here this morning. I apologize for the length that you had to remain in the docket, but I appreciate the very important testimony you've given the committee. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Our next panel is Dr. John Berthaud, who
it was actually a joy
listening
to Bertu,
who is the president of the National Taxpayers Union. Dr. Donald Bruce is a professor, the Center for Business and Economic Research at the University of Tennessee. Mr. David Bullington, who is the Vice President of Taxes at Walmart Corporation. Mr. Burr Morse, who is the President of Morse Farm Sure Works in Montpelier, Vermont. Mr. Jonathan
Zittrain,
who is the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School. Mr. Bertu, thank you very much for being here, and we'll begin with your opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for correctly pronouncing my name. It's a pleasure to appear before your committee as a repeat winner of the NTU Friend of the Taxpayer Award year after year. It's a pleasure to talk with you this morning on behalf of our 300,000 members nationwide. I come before you to state our views on internet taxation and your legislation, S-2255, which would extend the moratorium through 2006. The National Taxpayers Union strongly supports your effort, Mr. Chairman, and encourages the committee to act favorably on this bill. While proponents of more taxes on the American people have lobbied to establish taxes on internet commerce, a close examination of the facts reveals no justification at all for creating taxes on internet access, creating discriminatory taxes on the Internet, or perhaps most importantly, forcing vendors to collect taxes for cities and states in which they are not located, proposals such as Governor Leavitt outlined previously. I will briefly examine and refute the claims of the pro-taxing crowd and make the case why it's important to keep the destructive power of government as far as possible from the Internet. First, we hear that failure to establish a tax regime such as the NGA is proposing will lead to underfunding of critical services. And let me quote from their some of their NGA scare stories on their webpage, and this is a quote. States and local governments could lose more than $10 billion by 2003 in uncollected sales tax revenues and Internet and mail order sales. If this problem is not addressed, America would have 200,000 fewer teachers and police officers educating our children and keeping our communities safe. However, facts and a brief review of state and local revenues and how states collect their revenues will quickly dispel this type of hysteria. State governments, as has been recognized, are flush with money. In my testimony, you have a figure that shows, based on OMB numbers, state and local tax receipts have grown by over 30%, a stunning amount, in just the past 5 years. Many states, such as New York, California, Texas, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and others, have seen year after year surpluses exceeding $1 billion. The fact that states have so much money, and they are creating so much programs, endless new programs. In fact, there was a state senator from Michigan who admitted to the New York Times that they have new programs coming out of the weeds, and he said that only some of them have merit. This was in the New York Times just a couple days ago. The fact that states have so much money that they're creating these myriad new programs, again, some by their admission with little merit, seems to clearly disprove the scare tactics of the NGA and others. And make no mistake, Mr. Chairman, as you wisely know, a substantial part of the reason for this boom in revenues is the Internet, e-commerce, and the high-tech sector. Because governments at all levels have so far wisely left the Internet, e-commerce, and indeed the entire high sector alone, it has been able to flourish. In turn, these businesses have returned massive amounts of revenues to states and localities through the taxes currently in place. Adding new taxes to the Internet would adversely affect e-commerce and in turn stifle this revenue growth that the states are luxuriating in. A 1999 study by the National Bureau of Economic Research concluded that by applying existing sales taxes to the Internet would slash the number of online buyers by 25% and plummet purchases by 30% or more. Proponents, and perhaps fairness is a word that has been used by almost every person on the testifying and on the committee this morning, proponents of new tax regimes say that it is currently it is unfair that Internet businesses are not subject to new types of, or not subject to sales taxes and other taxes, and that they are supposedly escaping their obligation to fund quote-unquote needed government services. Again, nothing could be further than the truth. Anyone who knows about state and local taxes knows that, all businesses, large and small, face a myriad of other taxes. Beyond the sales and use tax, they pay corporate income taxes, employees pay personal income taxes, property taxes, and literally hundreds of different types of fees. When Governor Leavitt was recounting his story about all the sales tax revenue that was lost by his grandmother's purchases, he, of course, didn't mention that states and localities gained literally hundreds, perhaps thousands of dollars through other taxes that were collected based on those sales. Rather than figuring out new taxes to add onto businesses, Congress and the state should be focused on the ways to lower the old ones. For those businesses who currently don't have an Internet presence and who feel that fairness dictates the establishment of new taxes on e-commerce, our message is simple. Government is never the solution to your competitive problems. More government always ends up hurting commerce, and we would advise them to look instead to getting into the Internet or expanding their Internet presence themselves. In your vision, Mr. Chairman, we think and we share the vision of equity, and that the issue of equity and fairness has been fundamental to debates over the NGA's type of tax regime. And the question is it fair to brick-and-mortar businesses that if we do not have a NGA-type regime on Internet commerce? We would argue that every business in America has the opportunity to sell on a tax-free Internet, and what could possibly be more fair than that? As you well know, Mr. Chairman, the debate over taxes has been central to the 2000 election cycle. While you and others have offered wise and sensible plans for reducing the federal tax burden and returning some of the federal tax overpayment, what is also called a surplus, to its rightful owners, the American taxpayers, the issue we are talking about today is perhaps of greater long-term significance to taxpayers. We thus strongly support your legislation, and indeed we urge Congress to go further and adopt your legislation S-1611, which would amend the Internet Tax Freedom Act to broaden its scope and make the moratorium permanent. And we've also endorsed over in the House H.R. 3252, the Internet Tax Elimination Act, sponsored by your colleague, Congressman Kasich, which would bar sales and other types of taxes permanently on e-commerce. In closing, I would like to quote from one of the great political philosophers of the 20th century, former President Ronald Reagan, who observed that government's view of the economy could be summed up in a few short phrases. If it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. And if it stops moving, subsidize it. Now is the time, Mr. Chairman, to put a stop to schemes to tax the Internet, to keep it moving and growing, so government one day does not have to step in and regulate it or subsidize it. This is the challenge before you and the distinguished members of this committee. Thank you.
Thank you for that important statement, but also I want to thank you for the great job your organization has done for many years in informing the American people and being of assistance, providing me with additional information and knowledge over many years. I'd like to, before I call on Dr. Donald Bruce, this time to enter a letter into the record from the governor of Pennsylvania, who supports the extension of the current moratorium on access, multiple or discriminatory taxes. In fact, he points out he proposed the legislature approve a repeal of Pennsylvania sales taxes on computer services, as well as tax prohibition on Internet access charges. There are some states and some governors who I must say I think are more enlightened on this issue than others, but we'll leave that to others to judge. Dr. Bruce, welcome. Thank you for being here. I want to thank all the witnesses for your patience while we interrogated the first panel. Thank you, Dr. Bruce.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and thank you so much for this opportunity to present these remarks on behalf of myself and my colleague, Dr. William Fox.
Pull it a little bit closer.
Who's also at the University of Tennessee. We appreciate this opportunity.
And let me just a little bit closer.
Let me just begin, thank you, by stating that we are in agreement with the basic theme of this act. That taxes should be levied in a non-discriminatory way is absolutely fundamental. Our objection to the act's extension is that it represents a failure to act on an issue of such monumental importance. It places us on a policy trajectory that prevents meaningful cooperative action to solve the actual problems. First, it erodes the ideal of tax neutrality, the notion that decisions to produce or purchase a particular good or service should not be made on the basis of differential tax treatment. Second, it perpetuates reliance on a court-determined standard of nexus that is based on physical rather than economic presence. A consequence of this is that future effort toward simplification and improvement of sales and use taxes becomes even more difficult, and state and local governments end up losing significant amounts of tax revenue. The primary issue, however, in the great debate is that of tax neutrality. Essentially, the tax treatment of a particular good or service should not depend on how that good or service is obtained for final consumption. Differential taxation affects not only consumer decisions of where to buy, but also business decisions of where to produce. And in this electronic world, both sides will go wherever they get the better deal. And taxes can make the difference, thereby disadvantaging many regions of the country and many traditional businesses in the process. This idea is presumably at the heart of the original act. Discriminatory taxes on Internet sales should be prohibited. However, non-discrimination must go in both directions. In other words, the tax treatment of Internet sales must not discriminate against local bricks and mortar establishments. Subsidizing Internet firms through apparent non-taxation places a direct comparative disadvantage on local retailers, inevitably forcing some of them out of business forever. Now, a key component of the Act is its implicit acceptance of a definition of nexus that is based on physical presence, effectively limiting each state's ability to enforce collection of use taxes on remote sales. Extending the moratorium through 2006 will only make it more difficult for states to collect the sales and use taxes that are legally owed. Our research, which we have submitted in its full form for the record, shows that revenue losses to state and local governments, while not particularly large in the immediate term, will grow dramatically under the status quo. Admittedly, state and local sales tax bases were already eroding prior to the development of the Internet. E-commerce will only accelerate this historical trend and will result in our estimation of an additional revenue loss of $10.8 billion in 2003. It has been argued in defense of this act that states have enjoyed strong revenue growth in recent years. And we must note, however, that this is a cyclical phenomenon. Long-term revenue growth is not excessive. Similarly, the robust growth of e-commerce is a result of things like convenience, price, quality of service, and the like, and cannot be attributed solely to this act. Taxing remote sales like their local counterparts would certainly not kill the golden goose. To be clear, our position is neither for nor against big government. We are merely advocating the neutral, non-discriminatory tax treatment of all types of commerce, such that state and local governments can finance their activities as they see fit. The primary question, then, seems to be whether or not the sales tax should be preserved as a source of state and local revenue. Extending this act will permit the continued erosion of sales and use tax bases, and state and local governments will have no choice but to turn away from our nation's primary consumption-based tax system toward higher taxes on income and wealth. As it generates nearly one-third of all state tax revenues, we are of the opinion that the sales tax should be preserved with the following general modifications. First, Congress should replace the outdated definition of nexus with one that is more in line with the modern economy, based on economic rather than physical presence. Firms that significantly exploit a particular state's market should be expected to withhold sales and use taxes for that state, regardless of whether or not the firm has physical presence. Second, in exchange for this broader definition of nexus, states should be expected to implement substantial simplification measures. Included in this would be each state's adoption of a single sales and use tax rate and a state-specific definition of the set of taxable goods and services, presumably drawn from a uniform nationwide set of product definitions. These simplification measures would enable a more streamlined and less burdensome collection process for remote vendors. More importantly, production and purchasing decisions would be based on economically relevant factors rather than on differential sales and use tax treatment. It has been said that the sales tax is a dying tax and that e-commerce is just the thing to push it to an early grave. Our contention is that e-commerce can provide the incentive for Congress to work with the states to improve our system of consumption taxation, such that sales and use taxes can continue to be stable and significant sources of revenue. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bruce. Mr. Bullington.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for including a voice from the broader retail community in today's hearing. Sound economic policy in a free enterprise economy requires equal tax treatment of the different channels of retail distribution. The existing state sales tax rules, as constrained by Supreme Court decisions issued well before e-commerce, have created two fields of retail competition. On one playing field, brick-and-mortar retail stores, both large and small, are required to collect sales tax on behalf of states and localities. On the other, the largely unenforceable rules applicable to remote sales do nothing more than encourage consumers to voluntarily pay the use tax equivalent of a sales tax. As we all know, the use tax is easily ignored. Only across-the-board collection of this existing tax will level the playing field and rationalize our tax policy. We believe it is now up to Congress to resolve this issue fairly so that all channels of retail distribution are treated the same. Brick-and-mortar retailers are now at a competitive pricing disadvantage because, unlike many of their Internet and other remote selling counterparts, they must collect sales tax on most in-store sales. And unless they take drastic steps to separate their Internet business from their big brick-and-mortar businesses, they must collect sales tax on their own remote sales as well. Furthermore, customers who do not have access to the Internet, often lower-income individuals who can least afford the burden of taxes, must pay sales taxes.
while Internet shoppers, in most cases, do not. Access aside, the issue of credit availability is a much larger impediment to lower-income individuals. We're greatly concerned about the effect the existing tax structure, if not fixed, will have on our communities. We share everyone's concern with the tax burden issue, and in no way do we want any additional tax burdens placed on consumers. Without across-the-board sales and use tax collection, revenues will actually decrease, and many states will be forced to raise sales taxes or introduce tax increases in other areas, such as property taxes. In these circumstances, states will have fewer taxing options and will, as a result, have less control over their tax policy. As we all know, sales tax revenues are critical to the fulfilling of public services, such as schools, city streets, police, and fire protection. We believe that Congress may fairly require Internet and other remote sellers to collect and remit sales or use taxes, and that simplification is key, coupled with technology. We emphasize that even with simplification, any across-the-board collection requirement must allow for suitable de minimis thresholds below which mom-and-pop websites and other small businesses need only concern themselves with the filing requirements of their own state as required by current law. Additionally, appropriate collection allowances should be provided to compensate those remote sellers above the de minimis threshold for their cost of collection. There was general agreement in the Advisory Commission on Electronic Commerce as to the requirement for simplification. We believe that the states are willing to work together to implement these types of simplification. It will not work, however, to just say to the states, go simplify yourselves and then come back and talk to us. More is required. A framework, a direction, and a simplification threshold beyond which states may require collection. In inviting me, you asked that I address specifically the consequences of extending the moratorium. If Congress extends the current tax moratorium without at the same time approving legislation to achieve a level playing field for all retailers, future resolution of the issue will be seriously jeopardized. Already, many consumers have been led to mistakenly believe that the existing moratorium precludes sales tax on Internet purchases. I don't know who believes it will be any easier to resolve, I don't know anyone who believes it will be any easier to resolve the issue in 5 or 6 years. We urge Congress not to extend the existing moratorium without creating the framework within which those states that continue to move forward on simplification can aim for a threshold or date certain after which collection can be required for those states that have simplified. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Bullington, it's rarely that I interrupt the sequence of witnesses, but I have defended your organization when they come to Cottonwood, Arizona, and everybody's driven out of business because of what some view as predatory pricing and the enormous advantages that you have. And here you are talking about the insurance of a level playing field. I'm really remarkable. It's one of the more remarkable comments that I've heard in all my years as a member of this committee.
May I respond?
No. Sure, respond. Sure, I'm sorry. Certainly respond.
Senator, we do represent tough competition for anyone. Many of our best customers are small businesses, and they turn to us to buy goods for the same efficiencies of distribution that by way of our Sam's Club and even our Walmart stores, the same pricing reasons that they turn to the efficiencies in the Internet and for other reasons.
Well, some of the small businesses that had to shut down when you come into these communities, representatives were here, they would have a very different view of your impact on them and their economies and their lifestyles, which may be one of the reasons why there's been so much controversy associated with your locating in some parts of the country. I've always defended your right to do that. Now we have a technology that gives an enormous opportunity to so many people to acquire goods and services at a lower price, and you are here in opposition to it.
Not at all. We look forward to being part of that expansive internet economy that's out there.
Thank you. Mr. Morse, Senator Leahy has been here a couple of times in his desire to introduce you. He's so proud of you and everything you have done. And on behalf of Senator Leahy, may I say that we welcome you, and Senator Jeffers, we welcome you, and we welcome your testimony today. And thanks for being here.
Thank you, Senator McCain. Thanks for having me come, a small businessman from a small state, which incidentally has two senators. I am Burr Morse. My business is the Morse Farm Sugar Works in Montpelier, Vermont. I'm a diversified farmer and a maple sugar maker with roots back to the late 1700s in central Vermont. Diversification is necessary because maple sugar making is a seasonal activity that lasts but 1 month out of 12, and that is on a good year. To supplement the income derived from gathering and boiling down 40 gallons of sugar maple sap to get one single gallon of Vermont maple syrup, I grow crops and I host tourists in my sugar house. In any given year, 1 to 4% of our 50,000 visitors become mail order customers by placing orders over the phone and by mail from our annual catalog or newsletters. In 1999, we expanded our sales program into the electronic media market by publishing a website to increase the reach of our print and broadcast advertising. The site required an investment of $6,000 and incurs monthly fees of a minimum of $225. The response to the quality and uniqueness of our site has been overwhelming. It's what brings me to these proceedings today. I have been able to document visits to the Morse Farm that have resulted directly from the web, and we are enjoying some success with online orders. In real terms, however, our web presence is a long-term investment and not a panacea for the uneven cash flow generated by a seasonal business like ours. I encourage you all to visit www.morsefarm.com on the internet, but please recognize that it is not a dot-com business that is likely to appear on the NASDAQ charts one day. It is a way for me to better serve my customers to ensure their loyalty to my Vermont product. It is a new crop, if you will, in a field that, without time to grow, will not provide a harvest. I submit that a moratorium on taxation of internet sales until 2006 is the very minimum of what traffic will bear. My business is threatened daily by mega mergers in the food, travel, and mail order industries. Big business has won the battle, and without an affordable way to communicate with customers who want traditional products, I cannot compete. If afforded the opportunity of nurturing this new field, that is the internet, I might be able to recoup my original investment and find a little stability in a dynamic marketplace. And when I make money on my investments, I pay taxes on those profits. Talk of taxing sales over the internet affects me times two. My father told a story once about sending his hired man out into the woods one day to check on how fast the sap was dripping. When he returned, he exclaimed, "Mr. Morse, I counted 18 drops between the end of the spout and the bottom of the bucket." Now, either he was seeing drops that just weren't there, or he could surely count faster than a Pentium chip. Anyone who supports the concept of taxing sales made over the internet is seeing imaginary profits or drops and could, for short-term gains, stifle a new and up-and-coming market. No, it will still take 40 gallons of sap to create one naturally sweet gallon of maple syrup in the year 3000. But if taxed 40 ways, nobody will be making the effort, and nobody will even recognize the taste that came out of New England all those years ago. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Morris.
Thank you. Senator Brose, Senator Wyden, good morning. My name is Jonathan Zittrin. I'm the executive director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, where I teach classes on internet law and have done some research on the taxation of the internet, including an article co-authored with Professor Austin Goolsbee at the University of Chicago on the impact of a moratorium on internet commerce on state coffers and other aspects of the economy. Quickly, I guess, first, the bill in question today, the Internet Tax Freedom Act, apparently now renamed the Internet Anti-Discrimination Act, as has been said repeatedly, is by its own terms relatively uncontroversial and relatively modest. This is an act that is meant to proscribe multiple and discriminatory taxes. So far as I know, there are no states clamoring to impose either multiple or discriminatory taxes. The only place I see it actually is in Europe, which appears to be on the cusp of imposing 7%, their 7% tax on goods, for instance in Germany, a 16% tax on services. They then define digitally delivered goods as services, and suddenly a newspaper that is on paper is taxed at a much lower rate than a newspaper delivered digitally. This may be because many of the sources of digital goods and services are thought to be coming from the United States, and that may be then a tax to worry about. But at least within the United States, there simply aren't any taxes here that fit into that category, so it seems perfectly harmless to restrict them. Further, to whatever extent there's a subsidy to access, thanks to a restriction on new taxes on Internet access, such as charges by AOL or Mindspring, this also seems a benefit because the more people can get onto the Internet more quickly, at least while it's in its infancy, the sooner we can all benefit from the so-called network externalities. It makes more sense to go on as a vendor when you know there are lots of customers out there. You'll get more websites, which will in turn draw more customers, etc. But it seems also true to me, oh, I should also add, by the way, that Wally Hellerstein at the University of Georgia has written a nice piece that highlights some ambiguities in the current phrasing of the Internet Tax Freedom Act and suggests some ways to tighten it up. Those might be worthy of consideration. The real issue, then, is what is, in essence, an effective moratorium on interstate collection of sales tax that has been imposed, thanks to the Commerce Clause, through, among others, the decision, the Quill decision by the Supreme Court. That's a moratorium, as you've said today, that comes not from the Internet Tax Freedom Act, but simply from Supreme Court precedent, and that awaits congressional action to be lifted. And that's the moratorium that we're all, I think, really here about today, worried about what impact that will have on state coffers. We tried in our paper to make an estimate out of a total of $193 billion of sales tax collected by state and local governments in 1998. We estimate that only $430 million, that's a quarter of 1%, was actually lost thanks to Internet commerce that caused new transactions to happen interstate. To put that in perspective, one way of making up the shortfall would be to raise the average state sales tax rate from 6.33% to 6.35%. So currently, I think everybody agrees this isn't a big deal on state coffers. As you move forward, it's just a question of when. From what we can tell, eventually this will be a big impact on state coffers. Professor Bruce just mentioned his study and the idea that there'd be $10.8 billion in lost revenue in 2003. I should just flag a significant discrepancy between his study and ours, which are interestingly based on exactly the same numbers on input. We differ by about $7 billion as to the actual costs in 2003. We estimate that it's only $3.5 billion in sales lost, still less than 2% of the state coffers. And the reason, from what I can tell, for our huge disparity is how easy it is to collect use tax on business-to-business sales. Professor Bruce and Professor Fox say it's not that easy to do. We say it's actually the consumer sales that really pose the enforcement problem, and the businesses pretty much do pay their use taxes. And 90% of Internet commerce is thought to be business-to-business stuff by 2003.
So there's not right now a big impact on state coffers. There are these network externalities I talked about, things that make something like eBay much more valuable the more people who use it, because you're more likely to find the item you want or find a good price among a bidder. So to the extent that we can get more people on quickly, all the better. That all said, however, over the long haul, it seems that fairness must reign, and I define fairness as equivalent treatment of interstate and intrastate transfer of goods. It's true that state revenues are up. To me, then, the way to equalize things is simply to lower sales tax across the board, if that's how states want to return the surplus to the people, not to have essentially a Swiss cheese framework where some stuff gets taxed and some other stuff doesn't because of increasingly arbitrary lines like state boundaries or whether the material was ordered electronically or through walking into a store counter. So I guess my bottom line is the moratorium that's in question right now is perfectly unobjectionable, no reason not to extend it from a policy standpoint. The moratorium that is de facto in place, thanks to the Supreme Court's decision in Quill, is something that is relatively harmless to state coffers right now and is having some positive effects on Internet growth and the commerce associated with it. But sooner or later, it's just a question of when, the piper will have to be paid, and we'll either have to come up with a tax simplification scheme of the sort that Governor Leavitt was talking about, and any help that Congress could lend to the states in encouraging them to simplify their tax bases and their structures and the remittance and lower the burden on out-of-state merchants would be sensible. And the clock is ticking. It's just a question of when time will run out, and we'll either have to abandon sales tax entirely or actually roll back the limitation of Quill through congressional action. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairman. To step away for just a minute, and I guess we'll go ahead and start until he returns, and he'll be recognized, of course, and take over at that time. Thank all of you for coming. I mean, this has been a really terrific discussion on a very interesting and a very, very, very important issue that it really cries out for some resolution. Dr. Berthel, I know that you've never met a tax you like, no matter what shape, size, or form it happens to be in. But let me ask you, just sort of philosophically, I mean, what's wrong with a situation where my hometown of Crowley, Louisiana, the city fathers and the citizens of that community determine that it's appropriate to levy a 5% sales tax on purchases? That they're going to use it for police protection and fire protection, and some of it will go to schools. And yet have a situation where if some local citizen buys a pair of shoes at a local shoe store, he pays that 5% sales tax and it goes for those purposes. What's wrong with saying that that same person orders the same pair of shoes over the Internet for someone who's not located there, that somehow they should not have to pay the 5% sales tax?
I think, Senator, you ask a very important question. This really is the heart, I think, of the debate, as these panelists and the previous panelists have gotten to, that ultimately it is the issue of should we impose sales taxes on remote. That ultimately is the public policy question. We would argue that we would reverse the logic, if you will, and suggest that for those who suggest it's unfair for one type of business not to pay a tax, we would say that business can every business in America, it is the ultimate in economic democracy, we believe, and that's the beauty of the Internet, for any business to get on and shop tax or have their customers shop tax-free. And I would remind you that if that consumer purchases that item locally or purchases that item remotely, some government somewhere in America is still getting taxes, be it, as I said, property taxes, income taxes, corporate income taxes, individual income taxes. There are plenty of taxes on every single purchase that we make, whether there's a sales tax. Senator Wyden's state doesn't have a sales tax, but every single purchase, whether you see it or not at the register, has a myriad of taxes, and indeed every American pays 35-40% of their income in taxes. So we are not in any danger of if we exempt that purchase of governments running out of money. And indeed, we've heard testimony about the revenue loss, but I have not seen in any projection for any state, despite the growing prevalence of e-commerce, for in 5 years to have be collecting less revenue than they are today.
I'll go back to the point we were discussing with Senator Hutchison. I mean, her state does not have an income tax.
Very wisely.
But their state still generates revenues through the sales tax for all of these important purposes. I mean, I totally agree with her that if all of a sudden people start saying, well, look, I'm going to avoid a 5 cent or 5% sales tax on everything I can buy, I can get it almost as quickly by ordering it over the Internet, it's going to put a tremendous pressure to make up those lost revenues by establishing something that you also don't like, which is an income tax on a state level.
That would certainly be correct, Senator. And
I don't like that tax either.
No, but Texas is among the states that has had for a number of years over $1 billion in surplus. We see for the foreseeable future the far greater threat, and I would reference you to the, and it's cited in my testimony, the article in the New York Times. States have so much money now that they are creating.
Make sure you don't include mine. We got a $600 million deficit. We could talk about why, but
they are.
Most states have a substantial.
Most states have a substantial, and they are creating programs. As one state senator admitting that had some of them have merit, and apparently some of them don't. And that seems to us is a far greater threat to taxpayers. And again, the great state of Texas. For the foreseeable future, it's projecting, despite the expansion of e-commerce, it is projecting revenue growth at the state level, and indeed, there's according to Texas's own projections, there's no threat to the Texas revenue source.
My point is that my state has a deficit, a very large deficit, and they're extremely concerned about the loss of state sales taxes through the Internet. And my final question, if I might, Mr. Burlington, Walmart. I mean, if I was a smart fellow and wanted to really compete against your chains, I mean, I take it that under this scenario that we're currently under, that you got a Walmart in my local town that sells all the wonderful things that you do, and I got to go to Walmart about once a week for a Walmart fix. But I could establish Easy Mart and locate Easy Mart maybe in Maine. And I could survey everything in every Walmart store in my state and put every single thing that you have in your Walmart and put it in Easy Mart located in Maine. Establish a website that clearly spells out everything that you have in your Walmart store that I have in my Easy Mart up in Maine. Put billboards and advertise the hell out of it all over my state. But, you know, see it, feel it, and touch it at Walmart, but buy it at Easy Mart. And encourage people just to go through your store and see it, feel it, and touch it, and then come out and just go right out there and say, well, I'll buy it from Easy Mart. And Easy Mart would not collect the sales tax. I mean, that's a hypothetical. If I was really smart and I thought this was going to be the current situation for the indefinite future, I'd do that. I mean, not me personally. I don't have enough money to establish nothing. But, I mean, somebody might do that. I mean, would that be possible?
It's certainly possible. We welcome that type of competition. Just don't tie one arm behind us with a 6 to 8% pricing disadvantage.
So that's fine from a Walmart and most retailers, I guess, that are in your type of business, as long as there's not a discriminatory assessment or non-assessment of a local sales tax?
Absolutely. We might very well be doing Walmart whatever, side by side, selling on the Internet too the same way.
So from your perspective, is the discrimination. I mean, I agree that we should ban and put a moratorium ad infinitum on discriminatory taxes. I mean, that's terribly wrong. But the other question is, I think, very legitimate. Thank you. Thank you, Pam.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure, Byron, or is it you? Senator White.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have two questions for this panel. One for you, Mr. Citrain. You've heard about the governor's, proposal with respect to tax simplification, and you heard about it again today. What is your assessment of what it would cost the typical small business to collect and remit these remote, sales taxes? We have gotten, projections that for every dollar you'd collect, the burden on the small business person would be very substantial. What is your assessment on that point vis-a-vis the governor's proposal?
And is that under the way things currently work?
No, under the proposal that they have been talking about. And it was described again, you know, today, the centralized kind of system.
Well, what I'd want to know first is when the proposal talks about a de minimis exemption. So if you're just selling a few cookies every so often over the Internet, do you have to comply with 50 states' tax codes? The higher that de minimis exemption is, the more businesses who are mom and pop doing small amounts, just getting started, don't have to worry about compliance. Their cost would drop to zero. So one question is, how big is the de minimis exemption going to be? Another question would be, can Governor Leavitt see the states actually unify their tax bases? And by that I mean, if you're selling blankets, you don't need to know whether the blanket is covered in Nevada but not covered in Texas, that kind of thing. That you know whether or not, with respect to all 50 states, you've actually got something coming under the tax. As far as actually calculating the rate and doing remittance, if in fact Governor Leavitt's group can produce a system whereby it's one-stop registration, one-stop calculation, as far as actually figuring out how much to collect and where to send it, that can make it quite easy. There are these companies like Taxware International by which you punch in a zip code, the amount of the sale, assuming it's taxable, and it says this is how much you owe, and away you go. And, of course, with microtransactions, maybe it'd be quite easy to actually even remit the tax.
Well, we're just skeptical that that can be done. I think you heard me say I'm trying to meet him halfway and approach this along the lines of giving him a vote on a date certain with respect to doing this. It's just that some of the leading accounting firms in the country have done an estimate of what it would cost for the governor's proposal and for the typical small business person. I mean, relative to each sales tax dollar collected, the burden would be very, very great. I mean, as you know, you have to distinguish between cookies in one state and candy and profit-making organizations and non-profit-making organizations. And I think your first point was very very correct, is we have to see what the de minimis, exemption is, and, of course, the higher you make it, the less likely you are to flatten Mr. Morris there, and that's what's very, very important, and I appreciate it. I'm also put into the record the studies that have shown that, as of now, based on what the governors have said, the cost for the average small business to collect and remit the sales tax is very, very high. Mr. Morris, one question for you, and we're so glad that Senator Leahy pushed to have you come, because I think you are really the face of the new economy. You know, this has been portrayed now for 3 years as sort of bricks and mortar versus folks who are online, and they're going to be in this kind of bloody sort of battle. But Senator Leahy has really brought to our attention that in a sense, you are the integration of these two worlds. You have this traditional business, the so-called bricks and mortar business. You've got an online economy, and I and others call this sort of bricks and clicks. And my sense is that this has accelerated much more rapidly than we ever thought when we wrote the original, law. There was one study that showed that since the Internet Tax Freedom Act, 74% of the Main Street retailers are like you. They've set up a serious online kind of operation, and that leads me to believe that if and when our country has economic problems again, it's not going to be because of the Internet. It's going to be because of all kinds of, other considerations. Maybe it'll be oil prices. Maybe it'll be interest rates. It could be a variety of things, but it won't be because of the Internet. My question to you is, based on your involvement as a Main Street retailer, is it your sense that a lot of your colleagues on Main Street are going to go the route that you have and sort of integrate these two worlds because that's how you see your future?
Yes, I believe that they will. I know of many cases where that has happened. I had the good fortune to be interviewed by ABC World News back before Christmas.
You saw the show.
You saw that show, Small World. the subject of subject matter was Main Street USA and presence prior to Christmas over the internet. And there were several Montpelier businesses that stood to be interviewed by them, small businesses like mine, and were not interviewed. But I just feel like the new wave coming down for businesses, large and small.
When I went to school on a basketball scholarship, you always tried to make one shot to quit on. And I think when you say it's the new wave, I think that really sums it up. This is not going to be bricks and mortar versus the online world. This is going to be an integration of the two. And as I say, we're really glad that Senator Leahy pushed to have you come, and appreciate your coming. And all of you have been very helpful, and we've worked, I think, with almost all of your organizations, and we'll continue to do so.
Let me thank all of the panel. I regret that I had to go for a meeting with Senator Batchel in the middle of your presentation, but I have read much of it. My understanding from your response to Senator Wyden is that there are circumstances under which the simplification of the collection of sales and use tax would not impose a burden, and if that were the case, you would not oppose that.
That's correct. If there is a strong administrative burden imposed on those out of state trying to collect it, that's good reason not to bother collecting the tax, as our article explains. On the other hand, if there's a way to make that burden go away over time, it's yet another reason why moratorium now, but be sure you lift it later, actually makes sense.
The legislation that actually passed a subcommittee in the U.S. House probably 15 years ago now, in the late midst of the beginning with remote sellers, in that case, ephemeral sales, included a $10 million de minimis. That is, businesses that were not at a $10 million revenue threshold would not be required to be involved. Of course, would your business need that test?
Yes, it would. No, it's below.
The reason that was included is there needs to be, if you're going to simplify the collection of what is now a use tax, there must be genuine simplification in the requirement that the states impose a single rate against the remote seller, a single sales tax rate,
a common sales tax base, and in addition, there needs to be a de minimis that will allow smaller businesses not to get caught in the net. So I think in any event, when the compact is created among the states, it will include all three of those circumstances. And I don't know what the de minimis would be, but I would just say to you that what it was 15 years ago with catalog sellers in the House, recognizing the compliance issues, which then would not be radically simplified, but now it would, I think, with technology, the de minimis was $10 million. And I want to say that, Mr. Morris, for your comfort, because I think all of us understand those who are starting out, you know, you don't want to impose upon them significant burdens. In the state sales tax basis, most state sales tax administrators will create de minimis, but when their de minimis levels are normally the people who are doing $1,000 a year or $2,000 a year, crocheting doilies with magnets to hang on refrigerators and putting some brand name on and making $1,000 or $2,000 a year, well, you know, those are normally excluded, but that's a relatively low de minimis. With respect to this, the de minimis would have to be more significant. Dr. Berthet, I was interested in your testimony. You're obviously well-versed on all of these issues, and you talk about the pro-tax side. There, in fact, is not a pro- or anti-tax side in this debate, is there? Because we're not talking about a new tax. A tax exists on these transactions. So when you talk about the pro-tax side, what are you referring to?
That would be an example. That would be the type of regime that Senator Leavitt is talking about creating.
But would that result in the imposition of a tax that does not now exist?
It would result in already high state tax collections going even higher, yes.
So he's pro-tax because he advocates the collection of a tax that already exists?
He's pro-tax because he's advocating higher taxes on already overburdened taxpayers.
How is it a higher tax if a dollar transaction imposes a current use tax and Governor Leavitt suggests a simplification of its collection? How is Governor Leavitt advocating a higher tax?
Senator, we at the National Taxpayers Union look at it this way, that the average American pays at least 35% of their income in taxes of all varieties. Adopting the average American, and by the way, I will point out, supports taxes at a level of 25% or less. 70% of Americans across all demographics support that. The adoption of what Governor Leavitt is proposing would increase that.
Well,
it means more taxes for states. That's more taxes paid by taxpayers.
So you view tax compliance as an increased tax burden?
We view more taxes as more taxes.
Would you admit this, that the current use tax that exists on a transaction, if it exists, is not going to be increased by its collection through some other mechanism?
Absolutely.
And if it is not going to be increased, how then do you suggest that someone who suggests its collection is pro-tax?
Tightening enforcement mechanisms, creating a tax regime which would potentially, should he climb above the $10 million and become $10 million threshold, is adding taxes and adding a burden to both small businesses and to individuals. And I would also add, I would see it, our perspective would be very, very hard to create an exemption for businesses, or let me just say it would be a huge, seems to me a huge loophole, where you would have, if you said there was to be a $10 million threshold, you're going to have $15 million businesses split themselves in
half.
Yeah,
I'm not talking about the folks below the threshold. I'm talking about the folks above who would be collecting a tax that is already owed. Now, I graduated in a high school class of 9. I was in the top 5. And, you know, I'm not the quickest on all this, but my sense is that if you don't support the payment of taxes that are owed, then you must support the non-payment of taxes or non-enforcement of existing taxes.
Let me try and clarify, we do not support the creation of an interstate compact for internet tax sales tax such as Governor Leavitt is proposing.
You would not oppose, however, Governor Leavitt deciding we're going to collect every dollar of use tax owed in our state?
That is certainly his right.
And would you oppose it if it requires the employment of 1,000 additional revenue agents and the filing of returns of every Utah resident to comply with the requirement that exists in law?
We would not support that.
Right. Well, I think I made my point. I mean, I don't think you're, when you use the word pro-tax, I don't think you're using it appropriately or properly. I wasn't born into this world to defend Governor Leavitt. We're not even in the same political party, but he is not a pro-tax governor. He is here talking about collecting a tax that is currently owed, and a mechanism to do that is A, simple, effective, fair, does not obliterate your tax base, and I mean, we disagree on that, but I just want to make the point. I think throwing around this notion of new tax, pro-tax, and so on is unfortunate because I don't think it fairly describes this debate.
If I may, Senator, I would argue on the other side, I think it is terribly unfortunate for groups like the NGA to say if we don't adopt their proposed regime, to use scare tactics such as we're going to have to fire firemen and teachers and policemen. I think that is just as unfortunate as what you point out.
What taxes do you support, Dr. Berthin? Can you describe what kind of taxes you do support?
We support a lower tax on all Americans. We do not advocate zero taxation. But we think the current taxes at 35 to 40% on every single American, and this is what the American public supports as well, are far too high.
But tax rates above zero then would require a need to describe a certain kind of tax system. What would you prefer, sales tax, income tax, property tax?
If you're asking me what type of, it is up to the states what type of tax system that they have. Income taxes are the most pernicious types of taxes. I think our message here, my message, is an effort to say that the aggregate level of taxes is too high and should be lower. If the states want to have one type of tax or another, that's their business.
All right. Well, I don't mean to single you out, but you use the word pro-tax and so on, which I think is horribly inappropriate in this debate, and I wanted to straighten that out. Mr. Burlington, is you represent Walmart?
Yes.
Is Walmart going online to I read your testimony a bit ago, but Walmart's going online to be a so-called e-tailer online, is that correct?
Have been for some time, yes.
And are you separately incorporated to do that?
Effective early this year, yes.
And what's the result of that with respect to your tax burden?
We only collect for the states of California, Utah, and Arkansas.
And you did that for what reason?
Well, we did it because California is certainly a magnet as far as things going on in Silicon Valley, the whole Internet industry, and we brought in venture capital.
I'm not talking about the three states. I'm talking about the decision to separately incorporate.
Well, because of the reason to attract outside management, investment, capital, and to deal with the competitive issues related to sales tax collection.
If you hadn't done that, you'd be one of the larger merchandisers in the country with brick and mortar in every state and on the Internet, but you on the Internet would be required to collect sales taxes on your transactions, and your competitors would not.
As a division of Walmart stores through the end of 1999, we collected sales tax for every jurisdiction based on where we delivered product to.
Right. Well, this panel is good to come and share your thoughts with us. Mr. Morse, congratulations. I'm one of the great maple syrup fans in America. And we don't produce any of it in our state, so to the extent that I am able to access it, it has to be through the Internet, catalog sales, or in the grocery store, but bring those prices down just a little bit, if you will. But maple syrup is one of the great substances as far as I'm concerned. But thanks to the rest of you for sharing your thoughts with us. And this is not an easy issue at all. It's complicated and difficult, and contrary to what some believe, I think the stakes are very, very high here. And this should be done thoughtfully and done appropriately. I'm not someone who wants to injure the Internet. I want it to grow and flourish, and I want to work with my colleagues to find a way to solve all of the problems. And there are several problems here, not just the issue of preventing discriminatory taxation, which I will join in doing. We should not allow discriminatory tax. That's one issue. Let's solve that. There are two or three other issues. Let's solve them at the same time. Let's not believe that one has more weight than the others. Let's address this as a group of problems that we can come together on and do good things. I say to the chairman, I know, feels very strongly about this. I have great respect for him. And when we provided the previous moratorium on the floor of the Senate, we worked together to reach an agreement on it. And I will again support him on extending the moratorium. I hope, however, that we can work in a way that adds some things to the extension that will create some balance to addressing the other sides of these issues. And I would say the same with respect to my colleague, Senator Wyden, who also feels strongly about it. Again, thank you for being with us, and this committee's adjourned.
Nice to meet you.
hear it all the time, and I'd like any panelist that likes you to comment on that.
I'd be happy to. I think that there is no doubt that all of us every day make choices where we are trading off some type of risk against some type of cost. There's no other way to live. We don't have unlimited resources, and we live in a world where those choices are necessary. If we look at the amount of money the federal government has, even at its current level, it's limited. And the amount of money we have in the economy is limited. The agencies have to be saying at some point, given the amount of dislocation, cost, imposition on others, worth this saving in health and safety. It's got to be implicit in what they do now. What this legislation says is not make a precise, quantifiable point at which you value human life. What it says is not pin down the unique solution to the problem. It says look carefully at how much different types of rules are going to cost and see if you can do it more cost-effectively. See if you can prevent more risk more cheaply. And I think that is a good instruction to the agency.
I don't think that there's any question that agencies try to do that now. The tightening of the importance of regulatory analysis is actually the bottleneck at OSHA. The system is being run by the people who do the economic analysis, and the leader of that group they just put in charge. So instead of the health scientists or the engineers being the critical skill is being able to get out these analyses that will withstand the executive order review, that will withstand the subsequent challenges in court and the like. And that's the dominant feature. That's what's slowing things down. When it comes to the question of cost benefit, we get to, one of the first standards that OSHA took up was the noise standard. Okay. And that would be by any measure, it would be a major rule. And the problem is, what's the value of hearing? What's the value of the worker's hearing? How can we put that would actually be the thing over which you struggle. Those earplugs that you were provided with, we now know they don't work anywhere near as well as they were supposed to work, and people are losing their hearing, even if they were religiously wear those hearing protection devices. So now we're going to balance the cost of quieting the noise, and it's doable, against human hearing, what's the value of a worker's hearing. I actually don't know how to put a number on that, but I can tell you that putting that as a cost benefit question has stopped progress on noise statements in American industry. We haven't made progress in 10 or 15 years as a result of that cost-benefit determination being made actually by a review commission judge, not even by a real court.
Any other panelists want to come in? We got a little time left, so I'm going to take 30 seconds.
I feel like I'm trying to
remember. The difficulty you point out is a correct one, but the other question is, what is the best rule in order to prevent loss of hearing? And you also said in your statement, we know more about earplugs now than we did then. And so I think your point is well taken, but it's only to say a part of the picture. It's talking about not only the value of it, but what is the best way to protect whatever value that a person might put on it in view of current science, in view of what we know now, and work all that into the process to come out with the best result. Right, Senator?
Thanks. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anyone on the panel who believes that the passage of this legislation will not add
to the responsibility of the agencies covered?
Is there anyone who believes that agencies will need fewer employees because we passed this bill, as opposed to their current employee workload?
I don't believe that the you will need fewer employees. But I don't believe that for agencies generally you will be making any significant addition to the burden on them. Most of the agencies you are addressing these requirements to have very similar requirements at present. And generally when things are slow at an agency, the answer is politics, not science, not administrative practice.
That's right.
I just want to respond to that. Differences between this bill and the executive order that add all sorts of analytic burdens to the agency that they cannot actually use with the staff. You can just tick them off quickly.